Blog Talk Radio.
Mi chiamo Medinde Ojirafo Kwesi Ra Nehemputa Akan Eneye Ojira Da. That means greetings. My name is Ojirafo Kwesi Ra Nehemputa Akan. Today is Ojira Day. We are having our Ojira or purification program. This is part two of the piece that we did last week on actual origins of the term African, Moor, Black, Nigger, Hebrew, Asiatic, all these different terms. So the basis of the show for people who are new, excuse me, Ojira means purification in the Akan tradition, in the Akan language, but Jira is a term that's directly derived from ancient Kemet, and it also means purification. So as a verb, it means to purify, to cleanse, to purification, and so forth. As a noun, it's a celebration of purification, and it's dealing with ritual purification. It's the same in the Akan tradition, same as ancient Kemet. What we do, in fact, our New Year celebration is called Ojira, which is for millions of Akan people, Ojira is the New Year celebration. It's a time for purification. When we're dealing with Nana Son, which is an ancestrally derived term meaning Afurakani, Afuraikaini, or African ancestral religion. Ancestral religion, in essence, is the ritual incorporation of divine law and the ritual restoration of divine balance. Through ritual, we incorporate those things, objects, deeds, and entities that we need to harmonize with divine order, and through ritual, restore balance to our lives when imbalance occurs. So the ritual incorporation of divine law, the ritual restoration of divine balance. Those are the two halves of two complementary halves of the whole, which is Nana Son, Afurakani, Afurakaiti, ancestral religion. Ojira, or purification, operationalizes ancestral religion. And when we're talking about Afurakani, Afurakaiti, ancestral religion, African ancestral religion, African traditional religion, African traditional spirituality, whatever formula you use, Nana Som is a catch-all term. It's defined in the language of ancient Kemet. It's to serve the supreme being, the great mother and the great father, the divinities, and our honored ancestresses and ancestors. So we have a definition of that and details about that on the website, on the ojirafo.com website. But Ojira purification operationalizes the practice of Nana Son, whether you're practicing Akan tradition, because that's your birth, your ethnicity, the Yoruba tradition, Efe, or Fon tradition, Vodun, Igbo, whatever the tradition is, the expressions of ancient Kemet and Kanit, meaning ancient Egypt and Nubia, were taken by us as we migrated to West, Central, South, East, North, Northwest, Afuraka, Afuraikai. We continue to practice our ancient traditions. They became expressed through the cultures of the Akan people, Yoruba people, Ewe, and so forth, Mende, Wolof, Bakango, Bambara, and various other groups. And, of course, some of us were taken from West and Central Afuraka, Afuraikai, and brought to the Western Hemisphere during the Musuo Kesie, or the Great Enslavement, the Great Perversity, Musuo Kesi, the Great Perverse Era, or the Enslavement Era. And we continue to practice our forms of ancestral religion, meaning real religion, in the forms of hoodoo, juju, voodoo, and so forth, candomblé, various forms of the tradition. But these are the same traditions that we've had for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. We still communicate with the Great Mother and the Great Father, the Supreme Being, the Abosom, which is the Akan term for deities, the spirit forces that animate creation, the children of the Supreme Being, the embodiments of order within the great divine body of the Supreme Being, the forces of nature that animate the sun, moon, the earth mother, the oceans, rivers, sky, wind, tornadoes, thunder, lightning, the various planetary bodies, the various celestial bodies, the black substance of space, the spirit forces that govern all and animate the various aspects of creation are the deities, are the Abosom, are the Orisha, the Ntoru, Ntorotu, the Arusi, and so forth. So we still invoke them. And then we also deal with the Nananum Msamampo, we deal with the Egungun, the Kubito or Kubita, the Aku and Akutu, the honored ancestresses and ancestors of Afuraka, Afuraikai, that specific class of ancestresses and ancestors. Of course, they are only Afurakani, Afuraikai, either African, black, but at the same time, they're the spiritually cultivated class of the ancestresses and ancestors who are assigned to us by the Supreme Being pre-incarnation to assist us with our development. So when you have a connection to the Supreme Being, you invoke the divinities, you evoke the ancestresses and ancestors, then you have a full tradition. And we've carried that tradition for hundreds of thousands of years from ancient times all the way up to where we are right now. As long as we still get possessed by the spirit, the forces in nature, the Abosom, the Nananoman Samanfo, the ancestresses and ancestors, and they operate through us, teach us, allow us to heal one another, learn medicine, learn how to connect, learn how to defend ourselves, various things, and we still have a tradition, and it's been unbroken. But purification, Ojida, operationalizes that process. If you don't purify yourself, self-purification, Ojida, which is self-purification, Ojida, if you don't purify your body, purify your spirit so you can align with the divinity that's encased within the head region, the Okra, as it's called in the Akan tradition, the Okra or Okrawa, the Ka and the Kayet in ancient Kemet, the Ori Inu in the Yoruba tradition, the Lido and Vodun, the divinity that dwells within the head region, that force in nature that was assigned to you, that deity that governs your head, your spiritual head. If you don't purify, then you can't align with that force that dwells within you. And encoded within that force is the specific function you're given to execute in the world. Just like every organ in your body has a specific function, it's designed to execute every cell, supports those organ functions. We as Afurakani, Afurakani people, and only us as a people, have a specific function to execute within the great divine body. And it's encoded within our cry, our spirit's brain, the spiritual force that dwells within the head region that's seated in the physical brain, but the spiritual force that dwells in that area, encoded within that, is our function. If you don't purify yourself, you can't align with that function. So purification, Ojida, operationalizes, this is why we say that, operationalizes the practice of ancestral religion. Part of that operationalizing process is the incorporation of what is true, what is correct, what is accurate. When you ingest foods that are not truthful, meaning not in harmony with order, the order upon which your body operates. So you take something in that doesn't belong in your body, then that's not true, meaning it's not in harmony with the order, the laws that govern your biological makeup. So just like taking drugs or taking some kind of poisonous food, some toxic food, you take that in, it's at odds with the order of your organs and organ systems. Meaning it's not true, it's not proper, it's not genuine, it's not correct. So when you try to ingest something that's not truthful or harmonious, that's in harmony with the order that governs you, then you create disorder within yourself and you cause yourself problems. You develop dis-ease. It's the same thing with your spirit. When you take in sound vibrations, ideas, which are matrices that you try to ingest and hold on to and incorporate within your consciousness, and they are at odds with order, with what's real, what's genuine, what's correct, then that's literally taking in poison. You bring disorder into your mind, disorder into your spirit. You have disordered vibrations, disordered energy, discordant energy, a discordant view, a distorted view, a perverse view, and then you try to operate on that, and your thoughts, intentions, and behavior therefore become distorted. And when they become distorted and you act on distorted thoughts and intentions and your behavior manifests that, then you create disorder for yourself, and you create disorder for those who you are genuinely connected to, disorder for the Afurakani, Afurakani community. No different than somebody taking drugs and becoming a drug addict and causing problems in the community. You're taking a pseudo-spiritual drug, something that's corrupt, and then your thoughts, intentions, and then behaviors manifest that corruption and affects the entire community negatively. That's, again, why purification, Ojida, operationalizes Afurakani, Afurakani ancestral religion, or Nana Song. So this is why we go through this process, and this is why we have the show. We want to get to the truth of these various matters. So last week, and before we say that, look at the Kukutuntun, the ancestral jurisdiction. You can download that book. It's a free PDF. We have the soft cover versions as well. A lot of the information for tonight is contained within that book that we'll go over. Kukutuntum, Kukutuntum, the ancestral jurisdiction. You can go to our website. It's on numerous pages on the website, odirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in free, O.com. Go to odirafo.com, go to the index page. You can scroll through the introduction and everything, and you'll get down to the links. When we get down to the various links, the very first link you'll find is the Kukutuntum, the ancestral jurisdiction. You can download that book. We also just published a short note today, and we just released it today. It's called Or El Jizreel, and Israel does not exist upon the Mer Invita Stele. And we're going to be talking about that as well. So you can download that article. It's on the ojirafo.com website. It's also on our Facebook page on the notes section. But you can go to ojirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in free, O.com. When you go to the index page, this new article, Or El and Jizreel, Israel does not exist upon the Mer Invita Stele. To scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page, it's the last article, because we just published it today and we just posted it on the website maybe a little bit over an hour ago or so. So you can look at those too. And also, we're in the chat if you want to make a comment in the chat room. Of course, you have to log in. If you don't have a username, you can create one very quickly. So if you have any questions, you can start posting them whenever you want to. If you have questions on the phone line, just click on the number 1 so you can raise your hand and we can see that you're trying to ask a question, and we'll get to that. And before we move forward, a couple of announcements. We will be in Hartford, Connecticut, Saturday, Memenada, Saturday, July 5th, we'll be presenting in Hartford, Connecticut, at Cold Books at 5 p.m. Look on the website. We have the flyer posted. We have it posted on Facebook. We have it posted on the name site. Look on our Guamukasa page. It's on various different pages on the website, just in case you don't see it on one page, it's on another page. And you can also give us contact us if you need additional information. But that event is on July 5th. We have also scheduled an event on July 19th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Look on the website for that information. It will be July 19th, Saturday, July 19th at 1 p.m. in Las Vegas. The flyer is on the website as well. If you would like for us to come out to your city, go to our Guamukasa page or just go to the website. You can go to the Guamukasa page, G-U-A-M-U, Guamukasa, K-A-S-A, and get some basic information. But then just go to the contact us section on the website and hit us up, and we can organize something in your city. What we have been doing, which we always mention, is that every event that we go to, the various cities that we've gone to, we always try to give away a free copy of at least the book that we are speaking on. So we've given away over 300 copies, 300 free copies of our soft cover book since September to the various cities that we've gone to, various states we've gone to since then. We'll be doing the same thing in Connecticut, the same thing in Vegas, and we have some other events that we're scheduling to be announced, different states. We're looking at a number of different states. People have asked us, you know, shown interest of us coming out to their different states, so we're trying to schedule things now. So as we're getting this calendar together, if you want to fit that in, if you can fit your city in, just give us a call or send us an email at any time, and we can deal with that. All right, so what we're going to do right now, last week we dealt, well, a couple of weeks before, we dealt with the origin of the term Afuraka, Afuraikai, or Africa. We have a publication called Afuraka, Afuraikai, the origin of the term Africa. So we proved conclusively that the term Afuraka is the origin of the term Africa. So all the fools who've been out here promoting the false idea that Africa comes from Scipio Africanus or Leo Africanus or from the Arabs or from the Romans or from the from Sanskrit or from Phoenicians, Latin, all these false etymologies, we've totally disproved that, and we've shown in the Medutu of ancient Kemet, the hieroglyphic writing, the papyrus, specifically papyrus of Ani, chapter 17, plate 7, and the papyrus of Kunefer, chapter 17, plate 5, as well as the Temple of Aset in Paraka, in what they call Philae, the actual term Afrakai, referencing specifically the first landmass of earth that rose up out of the water that Ra operated upon at the creation of the world. So we actually have the Medutu, it carved, written, painted in the ancient text. So for people who have been misinforming our people for years, many have been misinforming our people for decades. Of course, the whites and their offspring have been deliberately misinforming our people with regard to identity, but you have black people who are misinformed and then some who are just agents of the whites and their offspring, of course, who are deliberately misinforming our people about the origin of the term because they're trying to push this nonsense like Christianity, Islam, Hebrewism, Moorishism, Nuwapianism, all kinds of nonsense. So we totally disprove the false etymologies, and we prove for the first time we're the first who published the actual etymological origin of the term Africa and showed it in the ancient text. So we have that publication. You can download it. We did an entire show on that. So that was a few weeks ago. But last week we did part one of this series, and this is part two, the second half, talking about the origin of the term African, which we dealt with that already, Moor, Black, Hebrew, Asiatic, Nigger, all these different terms. So last week, we went into detail, also the origin of the term God. So last week, we went into detail, we went through our publications where we dealt with the origin of the term God. We're the first to publish the actual etymological origins for that, the whites and their offspring. Only trace it back to a proto-Indo-European so-called root, two particular roots. We showed that those two particular so-called roots actually exist in the language of ancient Kemet, and they are titles of Amen and Amenet, as the great Ganga Ur Amen and great Ganga Et Uret. So we went into detail about that. We also, and we have two publications dealing with that on the website. We went into detail about that. We also showed that the term Nehesu or Nhesu Nhasu, which is a term for the ancient Nubians, an ancient term that the people of ancient Kemet used to refer to the ancient Nubians, and they referred to themselves as that as well. Nhasu, often written Nehesu, but Nhasu is also found in Akan, Nkosu. It's also Nagasu. This is where you get the Ethiopians using the term Nagasu or Nagas or Negus, Negus, but it's Nkosu, the root is Kosu, and we went into detail about that because many fools have tried to say that negus or nagas or ngas has to do with the term nigger and trying to make nigger divine. So we destroyed that in our publication, and we went over that last week. We talked about the origin of the term nigger, niga, naga, all these different things, netcher, ntoro, all these variations. That the term nigger, niga, naga, all of this has absolutely nothing to do. Nigger has nothing to do with something divine. It has nothing to do with a serpent power. It has nothing to do with deity. It actually, the word negro and necro, the roots that they find in Proto-Indo-European actually go back to ancient Kemet, and the term is defined as foes or enemies who are crushed or beaten to death. So a nigger, nigga, nigger, whatever variation you use, is defined as a foes or enemies who are crushed to death. This is a lowest level crushed, defeated enemy. So when you call yourself nigger, you're not calling yourself a great divine serpent power god. You're just calling yourself an idiot. You're calling yourself a fool. You're calling yourself an enemy who is crushed and beaten to death. So as long as you have that mindset and you're drawn to that foolish designation, that shows the perception that's been distorted. Again, Ojida purification operationalizes Nanasong. So when you purify yourself, you can begin to accept or attract truthful information and repel idiotic, nonsensical information and repel the nonsensical emotions and corrupted emotions that will make you desire to embrace nonsense. A lot of our people are emotionally unstable, some because they're doing drugs, smoking marijuana and things like that, poisoning their brain, poisoning their reproductive organs, poisoning their avatun, their melanin, making themselves receptive to perverse, discarnate, deceased relatives as well as non-relatives, who infect their thought processes, and so they think and act in a self-destructive fashion, spiritually as well as physically. So many of our people are open to, you know, foolish suggestions spiritually, but then physically we're corrupting our bodies and poisoning ourselves and poisoning our minds, and we've destroyed our perception in that way, physically and spiritually. So because of that, we have a lot of information coming back and forth. We pick up on other people's emotions, other people's conditioning. We have inadequacies. We accept false information about ourselves. Then we want to feel good about ourselves and start saying the black man is God, the black woman is God, it's okay to smoke weed. I mean, all kinds of nonsense, because many of our people are emotionally unstable. So it's very easy for emotionally unstable people to embrace nonsense and then defend it with their life, vigorously, vehemently defend anything and reject anything that's truthful, because we've been diseased. It's just like if you get sick, you get a virus, and you try to eat some food that normally would nourish you. You try to eat regular food and you regurgitate it. You can't keep it down. The food that's normally good for you, your body rejects it because there's a virus in you. And the same thing happens when people are emotionally unstable. They take in that viral, perverse nonsense from the whites and their offspring and the agents of the whites and their offspring, and now they're operating on some foolish doctrine. So when truth is presented to somebody like that, they can't keep it down. They regurgitate it. It's repulsive to them. They get nauseous just at the sight of it. Just when you have a virus and you've been sick, when you smell some food that normally makes you have a wonderful aroma, makes you hungry, makes you want to go out and, you know, eat. Now the smell of that food that's normally good to you actually makes you nauseous, makes you sick, and makes you want to throw up because you have a virus. So this is, again, purification. This is why purification is key. Ojida purification is key to operationalize Nanasong. When you purify yourself, you can become attractive to things that are harmonious and repel nonsense. This is what we're doing. Let's look at, we're gonna get into, and we also talked about the term black last week as well. We talked about the term nigger, Moor, African, God, black. We went into a great deal of detail with the various articles that we published on that. We published More Means Dead, 29-page article, very detailed, exposing the truth about the term more, showing that it means dead people, whether they're physically dead and the damned, spiritually discordant, dead spiritually people, as well as the socially dead, those who are slaves, bondsmen, vassals, serfs, servants, wretched, sickly, diseased. That's what mer or more means. If you're physically alive, it means wretched, afflicted, diseased, enslaved, socially dead. For somebody who actually died, they're also called mer, which means dead, dead people. But specifically, the damned, people who are spiritually discordant after death, spiritually disordered after death. So whether you're alive or physically dead, the term mor means dead. It's a negative, pejorative connotation. It was a term used in ancient Kemet for that purpose. The whites and their offspring learned that term, which was a pejorative term to refer to people, calling them dead, physically and mentally dead and spiritually dead. They used that term and applied it to black people in general. And now fools are walking around calling themselves mor. So we had to expose that, and we did that in the article. We went into detail about that last week. If you download this article we just published today, Or, El, and Jezreel, Israel does not exist upon the Mer in Ptah Tele. Let's get into that now. Let's get into that real quick. And again, if you have any questions, just hit us up. All right, so, and the reason why we wrote this particular note, and it's going to become part of a larger work, we wanted to put out the basic information now until we get a chance to finish the larger work. We have a number of publications that we're working on coming out, so we didn't want to put this so far on the back burner that people had to wait to actually get the basic information that's contained in the article, so we just put out the note. It's a 13-page note real quick just to give people, you know, basic truthful information about this. The stele of Meren Ptah, who's a Per-A or Ain-Su, so-called pharaoh king of ancient Kemet, during the 19th dynasty, the reason why this stele became popularized, it's a victory stele, first of all, when Meren Ptah took his army into the north of Kemet. The Libyans were invading, they were attacking, he defeated them, and then he also defeated a coalition of other forces in Kanana, which is later called Canaan, and so forth, a number of groups in that region. And it's the stele, or the stone that's carved with the inscriptions, is talking about how he defeated all these different groups, how his army defeated these different groups. And this was common in ancient Kemet when the king led the troops into battle. Once they were triumphant, then they would have a commemoration of the battle, what ensued, who they, defeated, why they defeated them, and so forth, and how the Abosom and how the Supreme Being guided them towards their victory. So the reason why it became popularized by the whites and their offspring is because when it's talking about Kanana or Canaan, there's a specific number of groups that they talk about who were defeated. And one of the groups, it appears that, according to the whites and their offspring, they tried to make it appear that the term that was used was Israel. And this was very important because outside of this specific inscription, you don't have an extra biblical reference, meaning any reference outside of the Bible, a historical or true historical reference, talking about ancient Israel. The only place you can find it is in the Bible. Outside of that, you don't find it anywhere. They've been doing excavations, archaeological excavations for centuries. Of course, they haven't found it because there were no children of Israel. There were no Hebrews. There was no Abraham, Isaac, Ishmael, Jacob, Esau, Solomon, Sheba, Menelech, Moses, Aaron, Yahweh. None of these characters existed at all. They were not black. They were not white. They didn't exist, period. And we're going to get into that after we get into this article. But, of course, they're trying to push that myth that these people existed and, of course, that they're descendants of these people. And then foolish Negroes in our community want to identify with these fictional people and try to trace their bloodline to a group of fictional people manufactured by the whites and their offspring to enslave our minds, which is insane. So they had to, you know, put this out. So because that term they found talking about one of the groups that Mer Empatah defeated, they tried to say that this term says Israel, and here we finally have evidence of an extra-biblical account or reference for the term Israel, and therefore if the term Israel existed on the Mer Empatah stele, which is a true historical document, which is a stone, a carved in stone, quote-unquote, document, then if Israel existed in the, as an ancient place, as it says in the Bible, then all the stories in the Bible about the Israelites must be accurate. That's the extrapolation. So the whites and their offspring have been promoting this, even though they know it's not true, but they were hoping other people didn't catch on. And then the Negroes who became Hebrews and Moors and Muslims and so forth, they've embraced it as well because they've found that, of course, there's no evidence, of course, of any ancient Hebrews, there's their life because they didn't exist. But they're committed to this false religion, pseudo-religion. They're trying to force on our people, some of them deliberately, some of them, many of them out of ignorance. So therefore, they started researching, and they found to their dismay that you can't find any evidence of anything in the Bible dealing with these characters, including just the Hebrew people, period. Outside of the Bible, it does not exist. So now they have to figure out something. Now they're scrambling. They're looking for evidence. And then the whites and their offspring give them a little, you know, fig, this stele. And according to them, they say, well, man, this says Israel. There isn't Israel. So we must be children of Israel. Everything is true. And they've been hanging their hats on the Mer Empatah stele for a few years now. Well, in reality, the inscription does not say Israel. It never did. And some of them know this. They were hoping that we didn't find out, and nobody released the information. As we said last week, these groups have been around for a while. The Nation of Islam has been around for over 80 years, talking about the children of Israel. The Hebrews have been around for almost as long, Moorish Hebrews and everything else. They've been along for a very long time. So-called Moors have been around for 100 years. And, of course, the Christians, black people brainwashed from Christianity, have been around for over 100 years. So because the popular culture promotes Christianity, most of our people who say they are affiliated with some form of pseudo-religion is usually Christianity because this culture promotes that. But then you have a small portion of our people, less than 1%, less than 0.1%, really, 0.01%, who have embraced Moorishism, Islam, and these other, you know, Hebrewism and all this nonsense. Over the past 100 years or so, 80-plus years, most people didn't pay any attention to the Moors, the Hebrews, the Muslims, and so forth, outside of people liking Malcolm X or, you know, some other figure. They really didn't pay attention because nobody was going to join these cults. Nobody cared. Nobody just gave a damn at all. They just gave them a pass because they weren't paying attention anyway. Very recently, because of the surge of activity on YouTube and people getting smartphones and things like that, two things have taken place. They've gained new life because now people in the poorest areas, no matter how economically deprived people are, they'll have a cell phone, they can watch a video on their cell phone even if they don't have a laptop, if they don't have internet access at home, if they don't have a computer at home, but they do have a miniature computer in their hand, which is their cell phone. So the poorest person anywhere in America can get on YouTube and watch a video. And somebody can take their phone, use it as a, you know, a camera, record some foolish diatribe about Islam and Christianity and the Hebrews and Moors and nonsense like that, and immediately uploaded to YouTube, and then they can reach people. So now this is something they never had before. They never had this capacity to reach people with this false doctrine. That's the first thing that's taken place. So they, you know, new life, because nobody was, they've been around for decades and nobody cared. The other thing that's happened in common measure with that, commensurate with that, is that now, because of that, they're receiving scrutiny. In the past, nobody cared, so nobody paid attention, nobody cared about scrutinizing the doctrine that they were promoting because people weren't going to join it anyway, so they just didn't care. They just let them stand on the corners and scream and talk crazy and just let them go by. But now that they're becoming popular through YouTube, at the same time, just as popular, even more popular, are people actually scrutinizing these pseudo-doctrines and destroying them. And, of course, that's part of what we're doing and other people as well. Part of embracing ancestral religion is to embrace, of course, truth, but it's also to destroy disorder, which includes falsehood. So we embrace ancestral religion, but we also destroy Christianity, destroy Hebrewism, destroy Islam, destroy Moorishism, destroy Nuwabianism and all these other foolish doctrines, destroy them and remove them from the minds of our people, from the spirits of our people. So we incorporate law and we restore balance. We accept what is harmonious and we repel or destroy and reject what is disharmonious. You accept nutrients in your system, but your immune system destroys cancerous cells. So part of what we do is, of course, teach real religion, and people began to incorporate their ancestrally inherited religion that they came into the world with, deities that govern them, that they can harmonize with, and ancestresses and ancestors who they were born with, that were assigned to them pre-incarnation by the Supreme Being, to guide us throughout our lives so we can function harmoniously in the world. But we also destroy disorder, these false traditions. So the scrutiny has come, and now these things are being dismantled, and these fools are scrambling now. So the more they try to force these doctrines, the more accurate information comes out and destroys what they've been trying to force on people for the past 100 years, and now it's coming to an end. So this is just one of them. If you look at the document page 1, you look at line 27 on the Mer Impata Stele and the whites and their offspring, the soul criminal, of course, they even call it the Israel Stele. Instead of calling it the stele that's associated with the king Mer Impata, the Ansu, the king, they'll just call it the Israel stele. If you look at the inscription, it doesn't say Israel. It's actually Israel. And sometimes that place is spelled Jezreel, J-E-Z-R-E-E-L. The Jezreel or Yisreel valley and city is totally different from Israel. So we're going to get into that. Anybody who studied the Medutu when they first saw this inscription of Mer Impata, and it's spelled I-S-I-R-A-A-R, Isirir, we knew right then that that was not Israel. But, of course, people have been promoting it, so most people just let it go. So now we're going to get into that. But first we have to talk about El, the deity El. So, Ur and El. In ancient Kemet, the term Ur, U-R or W-R, Ur, means great in size, greatness, and so forth. When it's applied to individuals or entities, divinities, it means great one, powerful one, noble one, and so forth. So you have Ur. And then you also have Urat or Uri, which is the feminine version. So we show the Medutu for that. In Coptic, it's Ur, meaning the great one, great in size, and so forth. And it's associated with divinity. So you can have, for example, the great father is called Amen. The great mother is called Amenet, the supreme being, great mother and father who function together as one unit. Amen can have the title Amen Ur, meaning Amen, the great one. You also have Heru Ur, meaning Heru, the great one. You have Ra Ur, which means Ra, the great one. It's just an honorific title. It can be used and it cannot be used, but it's just an honorific title. Urt or Urat Hekau, the great one, Urat of divine words or incantations, ritual prayers, Hekau, which is a title of Aset, but it's also a title specifically, especially of Nebuchadnezzar, and we're going to get into that as well. So these are just examples of the title Ur, or as in Coptic, Ur, meaning the great one, associated with people, like a noble person, a person of high rank, but first and foremost, a title of a divinity, or the same usage we can find in the Akan culture. In the tree language of the Akan people, we have the same word. Of course, the Akan people migrated from ancient Kanat, which is a title of ancient Nubia. We migrated from Kanat to the western part of the continent and reestablished the Kanat or Nubian Empire, ancient Kanat or Ghana, the Akana or Akan Empire. After Muslim invasions, we moved south from that region, moved towards the Savannah and the Forest Belt regions, and reestablished Akana civilization in the south, and that's where most of the Akan people are. In the regions of today's Ghana and Ivory Coast, there are about 20 million Akan people collectively in those regions. And then, of course, that was one of the largest ethnic groups from which we were taken and enslaved in the Western Hemisphere, North America, South America, the Caribbean, and Europe. So, of course, the Akan people are directly descendant from ancient Kanat or Nubia, and ancient Kemet as well for those who migrated north into Kemet. So this is why the tree language of the Akan, just like the term Jida in Akan means purification, Jida in ancient Kemet means purification. Jida means a celebration of purification as well in Akan, which is our Ojida, our New Year's celebration. Jida also means a celebration of purification in ancient Kemet. The reason why these terms are identical from ancient times to now is because it's the same language, the same people. We worship the same deities by the same name. Of course, this is another example. Or and Ura in ancient Kemet, meaning great, the great one and so forth. Coptic, the late Kemetic dialect or Kemeti dialect is Owur. In Akan, the same term is found as Owura, which is the masculine term, and Awura is the feminine term. And there's a high pitch at the end of the feminine term. So Owura for the male, Awura for the female. In the Asante and other dialects, in the Fanti will be Ewuraba, but it's either Awura or Ewuraba for Fanti. Same thing. So Owur in Coptic, Owura in Akan. Owura in Coptic, Awura in Akan. Male and female, the great one, and so forth. In Akan, it still means master, my lord, mistress, the great one, owner, possessor, and so forth. It's not just a title, an honorific title of people with high social status, which it is in the Akan tradition, just like in ancient Kemet. Somebody said, mi owura, that means me, my, owura, master or lord or somebody on a higher level socially. Just like they would say sir or madam or lord in English. In England, we would say owura or awura in Akan. Honorific titles for social status. But it's also used as a title spiritually. So, for example, the creator of the universe, Nyonkompon in Akan, creatress Nyonkompon, for one of the common titles of Nyonkompon, which is the creator, is Awura De. Awura or Owura means master, owner. Atie means the thing, the universe, but also possessions, things, that those things, that which is created. So Owura De or Owura De means the owner or master of that which is created, the great one, the master, and so forth. Nyonkompon, Uradie, means the master or owner. It's the same thing in ancient Kemet. So you have a title of Ra in ancient Kemet. He's called Ra-Ur. So, of course, Ra is the creator, Raet is the creatress. By the way, Ra and Raet as creator and creatress are servants of and subordinate to Amen and Amenet. In fact, Ra and Raet, who create the universe, are grandchildren of Amen and Amenet. So the supreme being, Amen and Amenet, direct the creator and creatress to create the universe, just like you as a great being, you can direct your energy through your reproductive organs to connect with your spouse and that energy unites and you create a child. You can direct your creative force, your procreative force to create. You're the great being, but you have a life force and procreative force within your great body that you can direct to create. Amen and Amenet are the supreme being. Ra and Riot are the creator and creatress. Then Akan, Amen is called Nyame, Nyame, and Amenet or Amenat is called Nyamewa. There's a great father and great mother. And Nyonkumpon and Nyonkumton are Nankapon, the great pon, circular pon, Nanka, or serpent, which is Nanka, Onanka, Edanka. We went into that last week. Nanka comes from Ra Ka from ancient Kemet. It's the title of Ra. Ra Ka became Da Ka or Dan Ka or Odanka, Onanka, Onanka Pon, the great circular serpent. And of course, in ancient Kemet, you have the serpent in a circle representing Ra, as well as Ra'et. So Ra has a title in ancient Kemet. He's called Ra-Or, Ra-Or, Ra the Great One. That exact same title is the same title in Akan, in Yom Kumpon, Ouradie, in Yom Kumpon, the great master, owner of the created thing, the created universe, the Great One. So we have these titles. Or from ancient Kemet. Now, we also have an example of the Abosom, the deities in Akan, Awuku, and Akur, the male and female divinities who govern the planet Mercury, which is called Aku. Wednesday are their days. Awuku Da is Wednesday, or Akua Da is the day Da of Awuku, the day of Akua. Awuku is also called Kweku Anansi, the trickster in Akan tradition. Awuku and Akua, the male and female forces operating through the planet Akua Mercury, are called Set and Nebit-Het in ancient Kemet. They're the same deity. Now, we have two articles, one on each one of them, going into detail proving that Awuku or Kweku Anansi is Set from ancient Kemet and Akua is Nebit-Het from ancient Kemet. One of the titles of Awuku is Owuraku. It's the same title in ancient Kemet that we see a title of Set. He's called War Hekau or Owur Hekau, the great one, War or Owur of Hekau, words of power, incantations, ritual prayers, and so forth. War Hekau becomes Owuraku in Akan culture, which is a title of Kweku Anansi, a title of a Set. It's the exact same title you find in the Medutu for the same divinity. Ora Hekau is Awurakua in Akan for Nebit-Het. So we show that in the document, just showing that that same title, Or, or Owur, is applied to deity, the same names in Akan culture as in ancient Kemet. Now, that title, Or, is critical. It can be just a simple title for the great God, the great one, or Uru. The plural is Uru, or just plural in general. And for a dual plural, like two people, in ancient Kemet, you have the UI. So Ur is singular, the great one. Urui is plural, meaning two. And Uru means plural just in general. You add the U or the W at the end to pluralize something. So Or means one, the great one. Uru means the great one. Or Urui can also mean the great one. The reason why that's important is because deities are called the great ones. So we show in the text, Uru means the divinity, the great ones, the great gods, the great goddesses, Uru or Urui. Now, in ancient Kemet, there was no letter L. There was a rolling R. It's the same in Akan today. There's no letter L in the Akan language. There's a rolling R. So if there's a foreign word or a foreign name that enters the Akan language, or if somebody has a name that has an L in it and an Akan person speaks it or they write it down, they're going to replace the L with a rolling R. So, for example, the term mulatto if an Akan person writes it or speaks it, they're not going to say mulatto. They're going to say murato, murato ni, because the L is changed to a rolling R. Because the tongue taps the roof of the mouth once, when you pronounce a rolling R, ra, and the same thing with the L, la, the tip of the tongue taps the roof of the mouth, it's interchangeable. Same thing with the letter N. So this is why they're interchangeable. In ancient Kemet, the same device occurred. We didn't have an L, we had a rolling R for most of the dialectical variants of the language. So, for example, we talk about how the Ptolemies, the Greek invaders who referred to themselves as Ptolemies, invaded Kemet. The Greeks invaded Kemet, their rulers were called Ptolemies or Ptolemies. When they wrote down the name Ptolemy in the inscriptions in the Medutu, when they get to the symbol that represents, would have represented the L sound, they used the symbol for the letter R, the hieroglyphic symbol of the Medut for the letter R. So we would have pronounced it Ptolemy, Ptolemy, or Ptolemy, while the Greeks would say Ptolemy. Exactly the same in Akan. If somebody said something with an L, we would say a rolling R. That is critical because the term Ur, or Uru, once it was carried by some of our people up into the Levant, Kanana, so-called Canaan, and so forth, thousands of years ago, Uru becomes Ulu, Elu, and so forth. El, Al, Ilu, and so forth. So when you talk about the great Kanana deity, or so-called Canaanite deity, El, or Al, or Ulu, that comes from Uru, meaning the great one. That's why in ancient Kanana, pre-Aryan invasion, before the whites and their offspring came, Uru, or Ur, is the great one. It's a generic title meaning the great one, just as it meant in ancient Kemet. Uru and Kemet, Ulu and Elu and Alu, and Al, El, Ul, Ilu and Sumer and so forth, all these variations of the same title meaning the great one, but it also can refer to the great God, talking about the creator as well as the creatress and so forth. This is critical because this is directly related to the title that you find in the Mer and Batah Sele. We should also show that Uru becomes Olu in the Yoruba tradition. So you have Olorun, Oniorun becomes Olorun, Olokun, Olua, and so forth. This is the exact same title you find in Yoruba, Olu. You find it in Owura, in Akan, Uru, in ancient Kemet, Ul, Al, El, Ilu, and so forth in Kanana, so-called Canaanite. And later when the whites and their offspring invaded the culture, they learned about that title and began to utilize it as well. So that part, it goes on page 5. So we deal with that. And then once we deal with that, so you can understand where this title comes from, now we talk about the divinity. We show some information about the deity, the great deity from Kanana called El. And we show the various linguistic forms, Ugaritic, Phoenician, which is quote from Wikipedia, actually, but you can find this in any etymological dictionary dealing with these languages. Ugaritic, Phoenician, so-called Hebrew, Aramaic, Akkadian. You'll find the various forms of Ur. It starts from Ur. That's key, which most people don't recognize, that the root of that title in the Levant actually was carried from ancient Kemet, and it's the title Ur from ancient Kemet, which became Ul, Al, El, and so forth. This is why you find in Ugaritic, you find in Phoenician, so-called Hebrew, Aramaic, Akkadian, and then, of course, later in Arabic, Ul, La, and Ula, Ura becomes Ula, Allah, Allah, and so forth. Now, we show the information about the deity El, and now you know that deity has been there. That deity has been there before the whites and their offspring invaded. We show some images at the end of the article, a picture, an image of a sculpture of El. He's wearing the same white crown with the feathers that Asar, we show the picture of Asar right next to him, wearing the same crown. We also show some other artifacts from ancient the Jezreel Valley. So when you look at the valley now and you go back to the inscription talking about Mer and Ptah and his fight, because ancient Kemet was ruling the region of Canaan or Canaan, which includes where is now Jerusalem, Palestine, Israel, all these different areas up and towards Syria. We had colonized that area for hundreds of years. So throughout the period, when they say the fictional characters were going back and forth, going to Egypt and sojourning in Egypt, and there was an exodus, and they went out back into Israel and all this other nonsense, in reality, the people of ancient Kemet, for all those hundreds of years when they were trying to place this fictional story during that time period, we were colonizing that entire area. So when they say the children of Israel escaped and went up into, you know, Canaan, the land of Canaan and all this other stuff, and escaped from the Egyptians, well, in reality, that whole area was being ruled by the quote-unquote Egyptians. So what were they escaping to? Because we were ruling that area. That was our area. It's no different than, you know, the United States ruling Alaska. If somebody said, I'm escaping the United States and I'm going to escape to Alaska. Well, Alaska is further away from the mainland, but it's part of the United States. So you didn't escape the United States. You're still under the jurisdiction, under the rulership of the United States. This is part of the anachronism of these foolish doctrines and foolish stories. We next have some information on the valley, which is key. Now that we know that Ur, the great god, becomes Ul or Al or El in Canaan or Canaan, when we migrated up in that region over 6,000 years ago, and we've been there ever since, and then even Kemet as a polity, as a nation, begins to colonize ancient Canaan as well, and still practicing the same religion with the same divinities, the same deities. And we also show in this document that El or Ur is actually different from Yahweh, which is a corruption of a title of Tehuti. These are two different divinities. Yahweh is a fictional character, of course, is a corruption of a title of Tehuti. But even when they corrupt the names and so forth and try to manufacture this story, El and Yahweh are two different deities. It's really Ra and Tehuti, Yah Tehuti, Yahu Tehuti. So we're going to get into that. Because Tehuti is called Hapway as well. So we show that we've had this culture, had these deities, had these names for thousands of years in the area. The Jezreel Valley has been inhabited for thousands of years, over 6,000 years, even going back 5,500 years ago, what they call the Gosulian culture, and they say it had affinities with the Amoritian culture of Upper Kemet and Lower Kemet. That's because we carried the same culture from Kemet up into that area. So we've been in the Jezreel Valley or the Isiriel Valley for thousands of years. It was named after, it literally means El Jezir, means to sow, as in sowing seeds. And, of course, El is the divinity. So Jezreel means El sows, or El sows the seed. There's a lot of deserts around that area, but the Jezreel Valley is a plush, green, deeply fertile valley right in the midst of a lot of deserts and a lot of rocky terrain. So that fertile valley, because there was a mountain range on one side and because there's a river on the other side, that terrain became an area where people would have to pass through if they were trying to get to Syria and different areas. So it was a lot of interaction in that area. We migrated up into that area first. We got to that fertile plain, which is one of the only major fertile plains in that area at that size, and we established civilization in that area over 6,000 years ago. So our people had been there for thousands of years, worshiping the same deities, practicing the same ancient ancestral religion and so forth. The name of the valley, Yisrael, meaning El Souls, talking about Ra Souls, meaning sowing seed. It was the fertile valley. It's been that. So when Mer and Ptah invades the area later, because of course by then the whites and their offspring had invaded. When the whites and their offspring invade from northern Eurasia, and they come into this area that's populated by Apurakani, Apurakaini people. And when we're talking about our people, we migrated from this area from Apuraka, Apurakai thousands of years ago. Same language, same culture. What are called the Niger-Congo languages, Congo-Saharan languages, what we would call the Kang, K-A-N-G languages, what we would call Eastern Kang, Central, and Western. But the Kang languages, what some people call Congo-Saharan and Niger-Congo languages, we carried that culture and those languages up into the area. And we continue to speak those languages and worship the same divinities and so forth. The whites and their offspring later invade from the north. They come in from northern Eurasia, and they invade these areas. So they hit southern Europe, and they eventually hit the so-called Levant, and they come in contact with our people who are already there. They're speaking Indo-European languages. They're Indo-European languages when they invade and they wage war, and they're intermingling, and over the course of hundreds of years and then thousands of years, some of their language and their speech begins to infect the Niger-Congo languages that were brought to the region, then that infected Niger-Congo language at its root becomes what is later known as Afro-Asiatic, Afrisan, quote-unquote Semitic languages, and so forth. That's just a corruption, just like the people. You have black people who migrate into areas when the whites and offspring invade in the northern parts, corrupt the blood circle of some of the people, and produce a mulatto-type population. The reason why they look like that, of course, is because there's corruption, there's pollution. They weren't originally like that, but that's what took place. It's the same thing with the language. We brought the language, of course, there was infection, and the infected version becomes Afro-Asiatic, Afrisan, and so forth, these so-called Semitic languages. Then when some of those people with the infected language now come back and migrate down into northern Kemet, migrate in further south into the Levant, into the Sinai region, into Arabia, into East Apuraka, Apuraikai, and so forth, and bring this corrupted language into these areas, then you see the rise of quote-unquote Semitic languages in East Apuraka, Apuraikai, in Arabia, and so forth. They did not originate there. There weren't ancient black Semites who existed, and then they went up into the Levant and then came back. When we left Apuraka, Apuraikai, we were not Semites. And nobody is Semite because there was a fictional character, Sem or Shem, who never existed. But these languages were Kang languages, or what some would call Congo-Saharan and Niger-Congo languages first. We went up into the areas, continued to speak those languages. The so-called Sumerian languages were Niger-Congo languages. The people were our people. The people in Levant and in southern Europe, we were all speaking the same language we brought from North Apuraka, Apuraikai. They didn't become infected until much later on by the whites and their offspring. But prior to that happening, that valley, we were inhabiting that valley. It was called Yisrael. Yisrael, because it means El souls, or the deity souls, soul seeds in that fertile valley. That's the exact name that we used thousands of years ago, and it's the exact same name you find on the Mer en Ptah stele. And it says, and we show it in the article, he's talking about how he defeated the various groups, Ashkelon, Gezer, Yanoam, and others, and they're given these different determinatives for cities. But when it gets to Yisrael, the determinative medut, or the hieroglyphic symbols that represent what kind of place it is, it doesn't show a city. It just shows the throw stick by a mountain range, which shows it's a foreign territory. It's talking about a group, a region, and so forth. So the specific text says, just like he destroyed other groups, when he came to Yisrael, he said, Yisrael, his seed is wasted. His seed is not. His seed is wasted. His bare seed. Yisrael is bare seed. Meaning the region where El sows his seed, that great fertile valley. Once the armies came, waged war, destroyed the people, destroyed the valley, one of the things that in ancient Kemet they would do, they would destroy the agriculture in a certain area. If your enemy is waging war against you and you destroy the fields, you destroy the area, now you've destroyed the people. Because not only have you taken over and you've defended yourself and destroyed the people, but now you put them in a famine. You destroy their crops. The following year, you know, they didn't have refrigerated trucks and all these different things. The following year, they won't have a yield because you destroyed their crops. Now they're going to be in famine. They're either going to die out or they're going to be dependent on you to help them. And now they become your vassals. Now they can be colonized because they waged war against you. You were stronger. You didn't just fight them, defeat them, and let them run back and lick their wounds and develop again so they can come back. You not only defeated them in war, but you also destroyed their agriculture. You wasted their seed. You destroyed their seed. So now they would have famine the following year, and they would not only have been defeated physically, but they're defeated with regard to resources. Then they become dependent, and it's hard for them to fight the people that fight, you know, bite the hand that feeds them. That formulaic response, or, you know, this nation or this group or this people or this region is wasted or bare of seed or made bare of seed. That was a formulaic phrase that was used on numerous occasions to numerous different groups when the armies of ancient men would wage war, and they would record that on their victory stela. This place is now bare of seed. So it had two meanings. The regular military meaning of is bare of seed. The seed is wasted. Their seed or their grain is not. It's gone. It's destroyed. The second meaning is because of the nature of that region, the Yisrir Valley, meaning El or Ur El Yisir Souls, El Souls. This whole valley was so fertile, it was called the valley that El sold his seed. They destroyed that valley. So now the seed literally was wasted. The valley of El's seed has been wasted. It has been taken out, torn up, burned up, destroyed. So that's what it means when the seed is not. El's seed in the valley is destroyed. That's all that it means. And this is an ancient title, and it's been that title before the biblical nonsense. Now, the fools, the so-called Hebrews, would like to say that it really means Israel or Yisrael, and when it's talking about the seed is not, that means they, you know, destroyed the seed or the lineage of the children of Israel and the house of Israel and all this nonsense that you find in the Bible. But it's totally inaccurate because they didn't understand the name of the region, why it was named that, why it was associated with seed, why Yisrael or Yisrael means the valley where El sowed his seed, the great fertile valley, which was different from the surrounding areas. They didn't know any of that, so they just ran with it. And then they thought it was a people associated, and because they didn't have a city determinative next to them, it meant that it was a nomadic people whose seed was wasted, and it seemed like it comported directly with the Bible. Total nonsense. The whites and their offspring have always known that Israel was not on the stellar. They'll pretend that they're having scholastic arguments about what one group is saying is Israel and other people are saying is Israel, but they're the ones who created the fictional characters of the Bible and the Quran and Talmud. They know, of course, that there was no ancient Israel or children of Israel or Hebrews or anything else, but they have to pretend like there's an argument, a scholastic argument, to keep us off base, to make us believe, well, some people are arguing against it, but some people are really studying the details, so it must be such a pitched battle. It must be something true at the base of it. All along, we're brainwashed. Somebody trying to trace their ancestry to a fictional group of people is no different than people we learn about Kris Kringle growing up, Santa Claus growing up at the North Pole and his helpers and so forth. And if you can imagine some idiots in our community trying to trace their blood circle back to Kris Kringle, the Santa Claus, and saying we're descended from the Kringles. And they start walking around calling themselves Kringles, wearing little red and white hats, and standing on the corner yelling at people talking about we're the Kringles and you need to get back to your blood lineage and your culture. Now, of course, some fools, some Moors, will say that Santa Claus or St. Nicholas was a Moor and he's a black man, and they're talking that nonsense as well. So it's not, you know, a reach for people to engage in some nonsense. But that's exactly what Hebrews are doing, Muslims, Moors, and so forth, trying to trace their blood circle back to a fictional people who never existed, trying to trace their blood circle back to quote-unquote Israel who never existed. Now, the Met in Patastele, of course, we've just shown that that has nothing to do with Israel. We also show a coffin of a Kanani or a Canaanite elite, a coffin in the Kemeti style, a Kemetic style, from the Yisrael Valley 3,300 years ago. They found this coffin not too long ago. It's showing, of course, the same ancient Kemet style of burial that we've been using in that region for thousands of years. We were practicing the same religion in ancient Yisrael that we were practicing in ancient Kemet. There were no Hebrews. There were no so-called patriarchs. None of that foolishness. Gods, goddesses, the same ones across the board. All of the nonsense about Israel and the Hebrews was a true historical fiction that was written into a false narrative hundreds of years later for political purposes. We also show a map showing the extent of the empire of ancient Kemet going all the way up into Syria. We show that. We also, again, we show the picture of El or Ur next to the picture of Asar, and we also show image of Tahuti. The moon is called Yah or Yao or Yo in ancient Kemet. In Coptic, Yo. In Akan, you have Jo, moon day, or Joada, the moon day. But in ancient Kemet, in the ancient dialect, Yah or Yao, Y-A-H-U, Yao. One of the titles of Tahuti is Yah or Yao. Tahuti, this is where you get Jah from, Yah, the moon, Tahuti. Of course, the bird, Tahuti, that ibis bird that they call an ibis or a crane, is actually called Habwe in ancient Kemet. Habwe is where they get Yahweh from. This is the title of Tahuti. This is why we show that Tahuti or Yah or Jah, Tahuti or Habwe, Tahuti, is different from the deity Ra. Tahuti is the spokesperson or the Ocheame or Oheme of Ra. He is the divinity of divine wisdom. He is a servant of Ra. So when we look in the divine, the book of the Cow of Heaven or the destruction of mankind, which we're going to get into in a few minutes, it'll talk about how Ra directs Tahuti to represent him in his place when Ra decides to go further into the heavenly regions. And he puts Tahuti in charge. Tahuti is a servant of and subordinate to Ra. Tahuti or Habwe or Yahweh or Yah or Jah or Yao, he is a servant of Ur Ra or Ul Ra or El. So El or Ra and Tahuti, Yao, are two different divinities. So when they try to conflate, first manufacture the fictional character Yahweh, and then try to conflate Yahweh with El and say they're all the same thing in the Bible, it's pure foolishness. Now, scroll down for a bit. That's on page 10, and then on page 11 we show the images of El and Asar, so you can see the continuity of the culture. Now, let me get a I want to look through the chat room and see if we have any questions. Okay. We're going to get into this. Okay. All right, now, you had a couple. All right, so you asked about the Apiru, and we're about to get into that now. So we're going to go into detail about that. Let me get one question on the phone line, and then after that question, then we're going to get out the cuckoo tum tum, the ancestral jurisdiction. That's what we're going to get into next. But Michiamo, you have a question or a comment?
Hello?
What's up?
Hey, what's going on, Quaze? I had one question.
Hey.
It's kind of off subject what you was talking about tonight. About the Aquadine bosons. I mean, the Aquadine, the names. Is the names and Akan and Kemet, are they the same for the Aquadine names?
Right. Oh, so you're asking, are the names of the deities of the Abosom that govern the 7 days of the week, are they the same in Kemet as they are in Akan?
No, like the name is like for Friday, like Kofi.
Right.
You know, like for Friday, or like Kofi, would that be the same as in Kemet, as would it be in Akan?
Right, yeah. So if we, and for the people who don't know about that particular page, we have a page called, when he mentioned the Aquadine boson, Aquadine, A-K-R-A, Aquadine, D-I-N, boson, B-O-S-O-M page, that's on the website. The Aquadine boson are the boson, or the deities in Akan culture that govern the seven-day week. So, of course, in Akan culture, we have a seven-day week. And when you hear people named Kwame and Ama and Kofi and Afua and Kwesi and Akosuya and things like that, we're named after not just the days of the week, but the deities that govern the sun, moon, and the planetary bodies that govern the days of the week. So sun is Sunday, moon is Monday, Tuesday is governed by Bena, or the so-called planet Mars. Wednesday is governed by Aku, or the planet Mercury. Thursday is governed by Yao, Ya, and Aba, which is planet Jupiter, but also Uranus and Neptune. And then Friday is governed by Afi, which Europeans call Venus. And Saturday is governed by Saturn, which is Amenmen in ancient Kemet as well as Akan. The spirits that animate those planetary bodies are the deities. Yes, so yes, the names of in Kemet, you can find the exact same names in Akan. They're either the direct titles of the divinities or descriptive titles. And we have an article on each one of those deities, and we show in each article how the exact same name you can find in ancient Kemet, you find there. So, for example, you mentioned Friday. One of the titles of, for example, the planetary body that governs Friday, or Fida. Da means day. Fi is the divinity. Fida, or the day of Afi. The male version is Afi, or Afia, or Afua. And that's the female version. The male version is Fi, sometimes Fi. So the divinity is actually female. It's Hetheru, the goddess, or the Abosom, female Abosom of the planet Afi. She's called Afi or Afua in Akan. She's also called Checher in Akan. That's Heher in Kemet. It's pronounced Checher in Akan. The title Afi in Akan for that divinity, it comes from the title Fai in ancient Kemet, which is the title of Hetheru. So she's called Hetheru in ancient Kemet. Then one of her titles is Fai. In Akan, she's called Checher, which is the same as Hetheru, but then her title Afi comes from her title in ancient Kemet, Fai. So it's the same thing. The deity Amenmen, or the deity Men, sometimes they spell it M-I-N, he's the one who's always inseminating creation, so they show him with an erect phallus, but that just means he's a force in nature, a procreative force is always inseminating to create a universe connecting with the divine female. One of his titles in ancient Kemet is Fai, just like Hetheru is Fai with a T. His is Fai, and he's shown with his arm up in the air, and they call him the deity of the lifted arm, but his name is Fai. One of the variations of that is Fi, and that's why in Akan he's called Fi. And any male born on Fi-da, or the day of Fi, or Afi, if it's a female, they're called Afia or Afua. If it's a male, they're called Kwafi or Kofi, meaning Kwa, servant of Fi. Kwafi, servant of the deity Fi. Or Kofi, servant of Ko, servant meaning Ko, or Kwa, Fi meaning deity. So it's the same with all of them. Bena is Heru Behudet, also called Beda or Bena. In Akan, he's called Bena. He's the divinity of war, metal, governs the planet, so-called Mars, in ancient Kemet, the deity of war, metal, and governing the planet Mars is Heru Beda. In Akan, he's called Bena, and that's why people born on Bena Da or Tuesday are called Kwa Bena or A Bena. And the female is Sekhmet, and she's called Bedat or Bedati as well. So every one of the names of the days of the week in Akan culture is connected to a deity, and that deity can be found in ancient Kemet with the exact same name. Okay.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So that cool, okay. Medase.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
That's it. All right. Okay, so Medase, for putting that link up in the chat, so that is the document that we're going to get into. So let's see. 1021. Hukutuntun, the ancestral jurisdiction. This is one of the seven books that we have out. And so, and let us say before we get into that right quick, we have about 12 books, about 60, over 60 articles. Some of them are extensive. Then we have about 48 videos, most of them about 2 hours on a regular basis, where we go through our documents and go into detail about our documents in those videos. And we will be putting out more videos for more of the publications because we don't have as many videos that match every single publication yet. We also have a number of archives for the Blog Talk Radio shows. This show today, the Ojira show, we've been doing shows since May. And then we have a show on Awukuda Wednesdays, which is called Egua Marketplace, where we interview and showcase somebody in our community has a product and or a service that's serving the community but also carries the ancestral values at the same time. Tomorrow's guest will be Brother Coach Bilal Sankofa. He's a very dynamic brother. He's doing good work in the community, transforming lives in the community. Look on our Blog Talk Radio station channel as well as the Facebook event notification. But at 9 p.m. tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, we'll be back on with Brother Coach Bilal Sankofa, and he'll be talking about the work he's doing transforming lives in the Afurakani, Afurakani community. So we have archives from those shows that we do on Wednesday nights, Awukuda nights, as well as the show, all of the Ojira shows that we do on Benada, going back to May. So you have those archives. Most of those are 2 to 3 hours. You have about 48 videos, which that's over 60-plus hours of information where we dissect the documents and the publications that we have. And then we have the books. All of the 12 books that we have out, as well as the 60-plus articles, are free downloads from the website. We've made them all free. Seven of those books we have in soft cover in addition to the e-book. We make the e-books free because we want our people to have the information because it's too important to just hold on for ransom so we can make it available to all of our people. The soft cover books, we print our books in-house on our own printers in color, so we do sell the soft cover books, and that, number one, that allows people to get that information in their hands for people who don't really like, who prefer to read something in soft cover as opposed to reading online. It also, you know, gives vivid images of ancient Kemet and the different things that we're talking about. It's something that can be shared. People can purchase these books and give them as birthday gifts. All of the books, the seven books, range between $8 and $11. So they're very inexpensive. So it also helps us to fund what we're doing. We don't, of course, receive any government money or anything like that. So everything that we do is funded through our work. So we give away the free copies of the soft cover books whenever we do a presentation and any other time that we can give away some books. When we do presentations in different cities, we do not charge people an admission fee to come listen to our presentations, we always stipulate that people must be, our people must, and only our people, of course, must be able to come to our presentations without being charged. And we do not charge a speaker's fee for people who organize events. So when we went to, just for example, we're going to Connecticut this weekend, we don't charge the speaker's fee to come out. We don't charge people $1,000 or $2,000 just for us to come out and speak. We don't charge a speaker's fee for organizers. You know, sometimes organizers have to get venues, they have to do other things. We're not charging for that. And we also don't charge the people a fee to get in. So, and we also give away a free book whenever we can. So, and we're going to do that this weekend as well. So when you do purchase some soft cover versions of the books, it not only helps, you know, you can get that information, you can share it with your friends, family, coworkers, but it also helps fund what we're doing. Right, so, and somebody said, no charge, you're single-handedly killing the lecture model. So we want to, you know, we have to move in a different direction. Our people should not, if we're talking about ancestrally inherited wisdom, ancestral religion, that's our birthright, that we come into the world with, then we can't say, well, you can't have information about your ancestral wisdom unless, you know, you have $25 or $15 or $10 to get in. We can't say, I'm not going to give you accurate information about Jesus never existed and Muhammad never existed and Moses never existed unless you pay me $10, unless you give me $25, or else I'm not going to tell you that truth. I'm just going to let you believe that these characters existed because you didn't give me $10. We can't move in that direction. We can't move in that direction. And especially since we have some information, we just can't do that in general, but we also have information that until we published it, nobody published it before. Nobody had the information about the origin of the term Afuraka Afurakai in the Medusa. Nobody has information about divine law and divine hate, where we show the etymological origin of the term hate, show the deities of hate in ancient Kemet, Eru Behudet and Sechiman, how hate is actually part of their descriptive titles and their names. People didn't have that information. So there's a lot of information about the Akan tradition and other traditions people didn't have, so we can't hold this information for ransom. And people are just not being informed, while at the same time, the whites and Arab Spring are giving away free Bibles every day. They got free Bibles online, free Qurans online, giving away free Bibles at hotels, giving away free Bibles in jails, free Bibles on corners, passing them out, dropping books of Bibles and Qurans off at black bookstores and letting people come in to pick them up. I mean, they're perverting, you know, our minds freely all day long, and some of our people are just holding on to information for ransom. Some of our people are holding on to information for ransom, and what they have is misinformation. And they're charging people for misinformation. So we certainly can't, you know, for any reason do that. So when you do purchase these soft cover books, they range between $8 and $11. You can go on the website, the Nhoma page on the website, ojirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A. F as in free, O.com, and you can order those soft cover versions. There's a discount on multiple orders as far as shipping, and we also have the program where for those who would like to distribute the soft cover versions of our books, you get a 30% off, and you can purchase them wholesale, and you can sell them retail, so you can generate some income while you're sharing the information. When people see the vivid colors in the, you know, the books, it sells itself. Those images they've never seen images of Tahuti or images of Al-Sar or images of these different divinities or these deities, you know, the artifacts from Akan and Yoruba and other cultures and things like that, as well as the information is detailed and accurate and things they've never seen before, images from papyri and tombs and things like that. So that sparked their interest because it's an ancestral, you know, stimulation. It's ancestral memory. They're drawn to it in the first place. So when they get accurate information in association with those images, it sells itself. As soon as you pull it out and hold it in your hand and they see the front cover, they're like, well, what is that? And then when you say, well, it's only $8 or $9 or $10 or $11 at the most, then, hey, you know, they're ready to buy it, so you don't even have to sell it. So some people, a couple of people, we have some people who decided they wanted to try the, you know, you know, being a distributor, and you're just an entrepreneur. You're not working for us. You're working for yourself. You're just purchasing the wholesale books from us. A minimum of 10 books, 30% off. So it's a cheap price, but then you can sell them, of course, full price. And you're just an entrepreneur, and you can generate some additional income. Or if somebody's not working at all, then they can, the more you sell, the more you generate, of course. So some people will try to do that independently, and that can be done over time. They can do it independently. So if you would like to do that, definitely, because we are trying to raise funds through the sale of the soft cover publications to fund the trips that we are making. Our preference is to be able to schedule these trips and organize these trips without putting that burden on the people in the different cities. So, for example, we're going to Connecticut, we're going to Las Vegas, the people have to find a venue. Some venues you have to pay for, some you do not. It just depends on the city and what's available. But if somebody has to pay for a venue or a travel expense, then, you know, that's the only expense that they would have to cover, our travel expense and a venue, if necessary. Our preference is to be able to generate the funds ourselves, so the organizers wouldn't even have to pay for the venue. We'll be able to cover the venue ourselves, cover our travel expenses, and organizers wouldn't have to generate any funds at all. We would just be able to set a date. We would pay for the venue, pay for our own flight and hotel, get out there, do our thing, and it's free for the community. It's going to be free for the community anyway, but even with the organizers, they wouldn't have to come up with the funds. So that's what we're moving towards. So anytime you make a purchase, whether it's one $8 book or three of them, that's assisting us in continuing to get this information out to as many of our people as possible. And we also, for some people, make donations. Like they may make a $5 donation on a website, on the same page as the book. And you can also make a recurrent donation. Like some people make a recurrent donation, you can click that option on PayPal where it'll be when you click concurrent, it'll be like a $5 donation. It'll automatically make a donation once a month on the same day, like June 1st, July 1st, August 1st. It'll automatically make that donation for you if you choose that option. Some people may choose to do that. We had like three people have done that. Like one person made a $15 current donation. So every month, you know, we'll get a donation, which we appreciate that because that just assists us. And then we will send you a book out anyway just because you're making a donation. Any donation you make, we're going to send you something. Okay. So, I see a few comments over here. All right. Okay, that's true. All right, so let's get into the Kukutunsun, the ancestral jurisdiction, because this gets into the various fictional characters of the Bible, Quran, and Talmud. We don't have to go through the whole book because we just wouldn't be able to. We've done the book itself is a transcript of the, originally it was a 3-CD set, 2 hours and 39 minutes, straight information. The 80-page book is the full transcript of that with some additional information. So we have that, and we also have a video. It's over a 2-hour video where we go into some more detail about the book, so we wouldn't be able to cover everything in the book, but we don't have to. We're going to deal with the section talking about Tahuti because this is key. So if you get to, let me look for the page right quick. Kukutunsun, ancestral jurisdiction. If you get to page, page 34. Go to page 34 in the book. So it's talking about the origin of Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael, who never existed. You don't have an Abraham, Isaac, or Ishmael, then you do not have a tradition. You don't have a Christianity. You don't have an Islam. You don't have Hebrewism. You don't have Moorishism. You don't have any of that nonsense. In reality, you don't have Hinduism either. Because Brahma and Saraswati and so forth, that's just the same, Abraham and Sarah and all that nonsense. And the reality is you don't have that because those characters never existed. So Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael never existed. We're talking about Abraham as a corruption of a title of Tahuti, and the same is true of Isaac and Ishmael, or Ishak and Ismail. We're talking about Heru and Set. They're fighting for who's going to be the ruler. After Set kills Asar, in the story of Asar, Set, and Heru, which we've gone over numerous times, Set tries to take control. Heru grows up. He's raised up by Aset. He's going to be the ruler. There's a battle between Heru and Set. Who's going to be the ruler? Who's going to succeed Asar on the throne? Heru is the rightful heir to the throne. So there's a battle between Heru and Set. And you have we have an article talking about the contendings of Heru and Set. And we clear the air about that, and they try to incorporate foolishness about bisexuality, homosexuality, which we show that that was never accepted in the Qumran, and we prove that when we analyze the document, the contendings of Heru and Set, another document. So Heru and Set in ancient Qumran, one of the titles of Heru, which is a title in general, but it's also applied to Heru, is Chek, which means ruler. Chek means ruler. That's a title of Heru. One of the titles of Set is Smai. Smai means to join or unite, but it also means evil associate or fiend. Set is the nervous system. He's the communicative system in the great divine body and within your body. That's why I say he's the communicator. Set in ancient Kemet, Kweku Anansep, or Awuku in Akan, Eshu in the Yoruba tradition, Legba in Vodun. He's a communicator, the trickster, red and black, the whole thing. In Akan culture, he's the owner of the desert, he's the trickster, he's the communicator, and so forth. In ancient Kemet, he operates through the planet Mercury. In ancient Kemet, he's the deity of the desert, he's the communicator of Ra, he's the trickster, and he operates through the planet Mercury. It's the same deity with the same attributes in both cultures. All right, so he's a communicator. Now, the nervous system is a communication vehicle in your body. Smai means to join or unite, but it also means evil associate or fiend. Set governs desire. Your desire can be in harmony with what's right, like if it's very hot and you desire water, the nervous energy moving through your body, that magnetism that created it, the energy circulates through your nervous system, that electromagnetic energy generates desire within you. That's the vehicle of Set within your body. It's the worldwide web in your body, the communication vehicle in the body. It generates that desire, but you can also have misguided desire. You can get out of harmony with order, and you can have misguided desire. You're lusting after someone or lusting after something. So that's why Smai, a title of Set, means to join or unite, because that desire creates that magnetism that joins you to the thing that you desire and you actually need. But it also can be evil associate or fiend, meaning now you're drawn, lusting after things that you don't need. That's a negative magnetism because you're off track. And you need to Ojida, purify yourself. So Smai means to join or unite. It can also mean evil associate or fiend, meaning you're off the regular desire, the joining or uniting to something, and now you're on the lustful vibration. Because Smai means that's one of his titles, desire to join or unite, but he's called Smai Ur. Ur, again, the great divinity. He's the great desire, the great energy of desire moving through your nervous system. In Akan culture, they show that in a different way. They show him as Kweku Anansi. Anansi means spider. The spider at a windowsill can weave a web that fills up the entire empty space of the windowsill, and now the spider can move in all the various spots in that empty space where he could never move before because he doesn't have wings, so he can't fly. So prior to weaving that web, that empty space was inaccessible to the spider. Once he weaves that intricate web, now he can go to any place in that web, and he can also capture flies and other insects on the web, and he can wait for them and plan and plot and everything else. He's the master of all the roads of that web. As Anansi Kokroko, the great Anansi, the great spider, he weaves a web of tumi, or power, in our kind of language, or a web of ashe, as they would say in the Yoruba tradition, that permeates the entire blackness of space, which includes the planet, sun, moon, stars, and everything else, and Afurakani, Afurakani people and all created entities, plant-life, animal-life, mineral-life, and Afurakani, Afurakani human life, and we're on that web, created entities, not the whites and their offspring, not cancerous cells, not unnatural entities, but created entities have a place on that web. And it's a web of communication, a web of energy that he weaves. And it's just like the nervous system in the body. He's the divine nervous system within the great divine body of Amen and Amenet. And it's a communicative web. And we can exchange energy because we're all on that web. And we get off track and we don't get the right communication. So he's Smai Ur, or the great Smai, the great one who can unite Smai. But if you get out of harmony with his energy, now you become an evil associate or fiend, meaning you're fiending or lusting and you're in disorder now. He's not disordered. You're out of harmony with him, so now you're disordered. So Smai Ur is the title of Set. Chet, ruler, is the title of Heru. He's the born ruler. He's the one who's supposed to come after his father and take over the rule of ancient Kemet. So Chet and Smai Ur are at odds with one another fighting. In the cosmology, Tehuti, the divinity of wisdom, is the one who is sent by Ra to pacify the two fighters, to judge between the two fighters and determine in harmony with order who should be the ruler and who should not. Eventually, it is ruled or judged that Set would not be the ruler. He would no longer, he tried to take over, and he took over for a minute. He was running the world like a tyrant. Then the judgment comes. And then they send Set away from the kingdom, and now he takes up residence in the boat of Ra, meaning he was deported from the nation. He takes up residence in the boat of Ra, and he becomes the communicator of Ra. That's why he's the communicator. In the boat of Ra, the boat of the sun, the Aten, where Ra sits in the boat with the Aten, Ra operates through the Aten. He is not the Aten. He is not the sun. And they say that Set sits in the boat with Ra. That means the planet Mercury, which sits right next to the sun, becomes the communicator of the sun, because the planet Mercury goes, or Aku, goes around the sun quicker and faster, of course, than any other planet. It has the shortest orbit, and therefore can carry the energy of the sun and broadcast it as it whips around the sun to the other planets in the solar system. So he's the great messenger. This is where we get Mercury being the messenger, and then Hermes being the messenger, but then the whites and their offspring confuse Set with Tehuti as two different kinds of messengers, and then they fuse the two and say Hermes was really Tehuti, which is more foolishness, and Hermes and Mercury is the same divinity, which is nonsense. There are two kinds of messengers. It's like an Akan, you have the Ocheame, which is the spokesperson, and then you have the Essain, who's the messenger. The spokesperson stands next to the king or the queen mother with the staff, next to the Ohene Ohema with the staff, and he declares what the king and queen mother, or the Ohene and Ohema, have to declare to the people in the palace, in the Ahimpie, in the you know, royal house. Once the declaration of the king and queen mother is made by the spokesperson, then the Essain, the other messenger, takes that message out of the Ahimpie, the palace, the royal place, and he runs all throughout the kingdom and spreads the message. So the first one is the spokesperson. He's the great messenger who stands right next to the king and queen mother and never leaves their side and declares what they desire. They speak to him, and he's the mouthpiece for them to the people. But then the messenger, the Essain, takes that message and runs all throughout the kingdom. The Ocheame standing next to the king and queen mother is Tehuti, standing next to Amen and Amenet and Ra and Raet. And then Set is the little messenger, the Essain, who goes all throughout the kingdom and carries the message. So there are two messengers, and the whites and their offspring get that wrong. So Tehuti judges between Heru and Set, who are Shek and Smai Ur, the ruler and the one who joins and unites, but can also be the evil associate or fiend. And because he judges between the two, and he determines in harmony with order that Set is to be deported, and Heru is to become the rightful ruler and take the throne of Asar, which is what happened, Tahuti becomes known as the judge of the two combatants. The term Ref means combatant or fighter. Refui means two combatants or fighters. Heru and Set, Eshek and Smaur, are the two combatants, the two fighters, Refui. And Tahuti is the judge of those two combatants. The term for judge is up. So up, Refui, is the judge up of the two combatants, Refui. And that's the title of Tahuti because he judged between Heru and Set. Ifrehui, Heru and Set, or Ifrehui, Shek and Smaul became Ifrehuim, Ishek and Ismail in Arabic, and Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael in, you know, Hebrew and English and so forth. These are deities, one operating through the moon, Tahuti, one operating through the sun and Jupiter, which is, or Yah, which is Tahuti, one operating through the planet Aku, Mercury, spirit forces in nature, Ifrehui, Shek, and Smaul, corrupted into Ibrahim, Ishek, and Ismail, or Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael by the whites and their offspring. It says that these were white males that were living in Hanana or Canaan or Palestine walking around. If you don't, so we show that these are deities operating. If you don't understand, well, once you find out that these are actually divinities operating through forces in nature and have nothing to do with people walking around, then you don't have an Abraham, which means you don't have Abrahamic traditions at all. Let's get into Moses, the title of Moses, to go even further into that, and then we'll get into the fictional Hebrew thing. One of the other titles of Tahuti is Ma'al Sheh. Ma'al means true, law, genuine, and so forth. Sheh means to voice, to speak. It means word, but it also means to voice or to speak. Ma'al Sheh means Ma'al Sheh, meaning true of voice, true of word, one who speaks or commands, Sheh, the truth or the divine law, Ma'al. This is a title of Tahuti, the one who speaks the divine law, voices the divine law, commands the divine law. There's a cosmological reason for that. In Akan, the term She means to command, to force, to command. And Mara means law. Mara She means law which is commanded or spoken. Ma'ara Shefo are lawgivers. They're the ones who She fix or voice Mara, law. To She Mara means to legislate. Marashefo or Marashe people are the law Marashe speakers or voicers or legislators. Marashe in Akan, meaning the law givers, comes directly from the title of Tahuti, Marashe, which is one who speaks or voices or commands the divine law. So once again, that famous title, when you look in the Imheru, the so-called books of the dead, and anyone that's written for anybody in ancient Kemet, they're given the title Ma'al Sheh or Ma'al Keru, which means true of word, true of voice, and so forth. This title, Ma'al Sheh, which is a title of Tahuti, true of voice, he's able to make other people true of voice when they make their transition. When somebody dies, their spirit leaves the body, they go to the weighing of the heart. Their heart is weighed against the feather of Ma'at. And if the heart balances out the feather of Ma'at because it's a light heart, because it's not weighed down by disorder and anxiety and criminal activity, if it's as light as the feather of Ma'at, then Tahuti takes note of the weighing, he scribes it, and then he adjudges the person to be Ma'al Sheh, meaning true of voice, true of word, one who speaks and lives the divine law. And once he's adjudged to be that, by Tahuti, then he can move on into the presence of Asar, who's the ruler of the spirit realm and all set, and he can live in harmony with the ancestresses and ancestors in the spiritual realm where the honorable ancestresses and ancestors are. That's what happens in the after-death state. Tehuti is the original Ma'al Sher, the spokesperson of the Supreme Being, the one who speaks the divine law, and he can make others Ma'al Sher because he has that capacity. He is also the scribe of Ma'at, or scribe of the divine law, An Ma'at, or scribe of the law. So, in the Book of the Cow of Heaven, called The Destruction of Mankind, Ra, there's certain men and women who are being disruptive on earth, when Ra's ruling earth. And then Ra tells Tehuti, come with me to a mountainous region, away from these men and women who are engaged in disorder. We have something to talk about. So Ra goes with the other divinities. They follow him. He asks his father, Nu, and the other elder divinities, males and females, who were in the primordial time with him, look at these disordered men and women, what they're doing. Tell me what I should do. I'm not going to move without your input. So he's asking Ra, the creator and creatress, is asking his ancestresses and ancestors, his elders and elderesses, before he attacks these disordered men and women, he gets their advice first. And his father, Nu, tells him, you're the powerful one. You have all the power you need to have. You know what you should do. Nobody can withstand the force of Sechima Sekhmet when she comes in the form of Heheru. So this is when there's the creation of Heheru or Sekhmet. Heheru is just a title of Sekhmet in this piece because Sekhmet and Heheru are two different divinities. And we have an article about that as well. So Sekhmet comes, the lioness goddess. She's sent by Ra to go destroy the disordered men and women. And once they're destroyed, she destroys these people. Waves in their blood at night, and the whole piece is a long story. But then after that, the men and women who are honorable, they took up their bows and their weapons, and they said they will finish off the others who Sekhmet didn't take on behalf of Ra, and Ra blessed them for waging war against the disordered males and females, and they waged war against them. After that process takes place, Ra asked Tehuti to come with them to a mountainous region, up into the mountains, away from some of the other disordered men and women who were not destroyed. And Ra takes the form of a divine light, and he's called Ra Aku. And Tehuti goes up, and he tells Tehuti to write down what is in the spirit realm. So he makes Tehuti, or Ma'al Sher, his scribe. And then he tells Tehuti he's tired of the disordered men and women. And so Ra says that he's going to go further up into the ancestral realm. And he says, Tehuti, you are going to be in my place on earth while I go further into the ancestral realm. And if people want to come after me, they're going to have to follow after me. But you are going to be in my place. And he calls him Afti Ra, one who sits in the place of Ra on earth. This is Tehuti being given his role as a vicegerent, a vizier, one who replaces the creative force who decides to go further into the heavenly realm. He says, however, I'll give you an assistant to help you in this process. And he gives him the dog-headed baboon that you often see on the temples, the little dog-headed baboon who's the assistant of Tehuti, and that baboon's name is Anan, A-N-A-N. So Tehuti, who's called Ma'al Sher, gets an assistant called Anan. So the god who takes the form of a divine light in the mountains that he called Moshe or Moshe up on the mountains to see the god in the form of divine light. That's Moshe or Moses going up on the mountain to see the god in the form of divine light. He makes him his messenger. He makes him his scribe, quote-unquote, Ten Commandments, scribe of the divine law. He gives him an assistant, Aran or Aaron, which is the dog-headed baboon, which is a deity in ancient Kemet. And now Moshe and Aram, Moses and Aaron, go and they become representatives of the great God to the people. That entire story can be found in the Book of the Cow of Heaven, which is also called The Destruction of Mankind. is in the text. It's talking about Tehuti, the fourth in creation that operates through the moon, who goes up into the mountainous region where the sun is, and there's a union of the sun and the moon, an eclipse. Energy of the sun is fused into the moon. So when Tehuti is given the place of Ra, when the sun sets, the light in the sky now takes the place of the sun, that's the moon. So this whole story is dealing with that, and it's also dealing with intuition and a number of different things. Now, before we go forward, if you want to continue to listen after the live stream, which will be up in 5 minutes, you can call in 657-383-0635. The live stream will cut off in 4 minutes now, but you can continue to listen in overtime on the phone. You just have to call in within the next 4 minutes, 657-383-0635. Okay, so you have Moshe and Anan. And this is, so that whole story is in the book of the Tower of Heaven. Again, if you don't have a Moses and you don't have an Aaron or Aaron, and we just showed Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael never existed, so you don't have the children of Israel, you don't have a tradition. You don't have Islam, you don't have Christianity, you don't have Hebrewism. Now, there's also part of the story where Ra says he's going to create the divine field called Sekhet Hetep. Sekhet means field, Hetep means peace, the divine field of peace. In that field, he's going to place Aru, which is food. It's going to be called the Sekhet Aru, or the field of food and the divine field of peace. So this is the great God creating, and he says the followers of Tehuti, those who live in harmony with order and follow along with Tehuti, they will be led to the divine field of peace, the Sekhet Hetep. That's promised for them, and there's divine food in that field, the Sekhet Aru. This is the creation of the promised land for the followers of Tehuti or Moshe, and they will get to the promised land if they follow Moshe, and they will get divine food, the land of milk and honey, the food from heaven, and all this other nonsense. The land of milk and honey, again, the food from heaven, that's coming directly from Tehuti and Ra. Tehuti operating through the moon, that's the lunar light in the heavens. Ra operating through the sun, that's the solar light in the heaven. Moonlight is milky light coming through from the sky. Solar light is golden, is honey coming from the sky. So the land of milk and honey coming from the sky is the lunar light coming, which is the milk, and the solar light coming, which is the honey, the golden light. That's the food falling from heaven. The land of milk and honey coming from Tehuti and Ra, Moshe and Ra, or Ra-Ur, or Ur, or El, and so forth. This is where it comes from. So, all of that is in the book of the Cow of Heaven. In that, also, Ra tells Geb, the father of all sons, summons Geb, the earth divinity, the male earth divinity that operates through the crops. He tells Geb, those men and women who have my words of power in their body, talking about the Hekau, the incantations, the matrices of power within their body, those who are receptive and who, you know, carry that kind of energy, those kind of people who can get possessed by the ancestral spirits, possessed by the divinity, those males and females, place them under the jurisdiction of your son, Asar. This is the establishment of the priesthood and priestesshood in this document. The whites and their offspring in this same document would say this is the establishment of the Levitical priesthood, and this is where they stole that from. But this is talking about Ra and Ra'et, Yev, the different divinities, and those males and females who can possess the deities of ancient Kemet, and we still possess them today. When people in the Yoruba tradition, they get possessed by the Orisha. People in the Akan tradition get possessed by the Abosom. People in Ebe and Fon traditions get possessed by the Vodou. These are the people who have the quote-unquote Hekau, or words of power, excuse me, of Ra and Ra'et in their body, that life force power in their body. And they're under the jurisdiction of Asar and, of course, of Aset as well. So this is where that entire piece comes from. Now, let me check to see if anybody has any comments. Hold on 1 second. All right. So we break all of that down. Moses and Aaron, night of milk and honey. Moses going on the mountain. The whole piece. We already broke down Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael, fictional characters. Now you no longer have any link to any fictional characters. Wife and offspring took forces in nature, deities, carnalized them, made them white, and then placed them in Palestine and said that they're directly descended from them. And then Negroes tried to blacken these fictional characters up, make them black, and say they're descended from people. We also already showed that Israel didn't exist. There's no evidence, of course, of an ancient Israel because the whole story derives from eruptions of Tiphrequi, Shek, and Ismail, which they corrupted into Ibrahim, Ishek, and Ismail, and Moses and Aaron. Moshe and Anan corruptions from Tehuti and Anan. Now, somebody asked about the Aperu, or the so-called, what people try to say are the Hebrews. There were no ancient Hebrews. There were no people called the ancient Hebrews. They never existed, period. Now, what the whites and their offspring will try to do is say that the people referred to as Aperu, those were the ancient Hebrews. Only problem is those people exist in various countries, and they exist long before, literally, thousands and thousands of years before the whole biblical fiction existed, as well as the time frame that they try to place the so-called Hebrews in that fiction. So you'll find those people represented in Sumer. You find them in different areas. You'll find that title or that name in ancient Kemet as well. Aperu. On one hand, Aperu means those who are moving, nomadic, all these different things, but then also ornamented, fully accoutrements and fully ornamented and bedecked and so forth. So who are the Aperu or the Peru? And why are they on one hand talking about to move, to evade, to cross, and all this other stuff, then at the same time, ornamented, accoutrement, fully vested, and so forth. The Peru or Pelu are the same people today that they've been for over 10,000 years. The people who are called Pula in some areas, Fulani in some areas, Pula, there's a variation between the P and the F. So, for example, amongst the Hausa, they're called them Fula, Fulani. Amongst the Wolof, they're Pula, Hel, Helu, in that language, because the P and the F interchange. You'll find the P and the F interchanging in various Afro-Arkani, Afro-Arkani languages, as well as languages across the world. So, the so-called Pula people, there are millions of them all across the continent. There are Fulani, Berbers, and so forth. And what you will find is these are the same people, the Peru, Puru, Pulu, Peru from ancient Kemet. They're the exact same people who are living in the Tassili, Njer region in ancient times, in the same region where the Berbers are now. This is why you have Fulani, Berbers in those areas. They were nomadic people. They were going back and forth. Sometimes they would invade. They still do that now. They invade certain areas. Sometimes they become semi-nomadic, depending on where they're at. You can find them from West Afuraka, Afurakai, North, Central, all the way across to the Sudan. They've been around for thousands and over 10,000 years. Same people. The DNA bears that out, and of course their culture bears that out. They've pre-Aryan invasion. Before the whites and their offspring invaded North Afuraka, Afurakai, as well as the Levant and Southern Europe and whatever, before, especially getting to North Afuraka, Afrika, and Levant, before they polluted the blood circle. The only reason some of the Fula people, Fula, have a little bit straighter hair and a little bit lighter skin is because of the Muslim invasions. But prior to that, the invasions in ancient times, when the whites and their offspring invaded North Afuraka, Afuraka, and began to mix, you see that in earlier dynasties in Kemet. You see pictures of the people in the Levant, and you have dark-skinned people with, you know, natural hair, Afro-type hair, locks and so forth. And then you start, the closer you get to the present, the lighter some of those groups become because there were invasions, blood mixture, pollution, and so forth. The same thing happened in North Afuraka, Afuraka. There were certain regions where the whites and their offspring invaded and settled, and where you get these invasions, prisoners of war, people being raped, producing mulattoes and so forth, then this is where you get that mixture from. This is the only reason why some Pula or Fula or Pel, Peru, Aperu, have these a little bit lighter brown skin, a little bit straighter hair, but then all of them do not have that. You have Fulani Berbers who look no different than the average Yoruba person, Akan person, Wolof person, or whatever. You couldn't tell the difference. So it's not always that they have, you know, the light skin, light brown skin, or and halfway straight hair. That's not the case. You have to look across the board and see where they are. They span all across the continent. Now, you also have the fact that many groups of them, like the Tuareg, Wodabi, and others, they're distinguished by, number one, the color of the cloth that they wear, number two, by their ornament, their ornamentation, accoutrements, and so forth. When it says they're well-fitted, well-ornamented, and so forth, and in the Medutu, referring to aper, and it means well-fitted or ornamented, and so forth, but then per also means to nomadic and moving and escaping and things like that. That's directly related to who they are and how they function and what they look like. Even the Phoenicians or Phonike or Punike, meaning the purple people or the purple ones, that's going back to the dark blue purple cloth that the people who are known as the Fulani and the Berbers are known for dyeing their blue cloth. They're called the people of the blue veil. Now sometimes there's documentaries and things like that on them. They dye that blue cloth, that deep, dark blue cloth. It used to be deep, dark, indigo, nearly black cloth. And the dye would get on their hands. So not only do they wear the blue cloth and they show up in the desert, and all of a sudden if you're somebody coming from another country and you're in the desert and all you see is the desert, of course, and all of a sudden you come across an encampment and you see this brilliant blue cloth, and everybody's in this blue cloth, and you look at their hands, and they have blue dye on their hands. They're black people, but then they also are wearing the blue cloth, and it was called Phoenike by the Greeks, and they were called the blue people. They're connected, of course, to the Akan people, Akanfo people, Akahan people, which is one of the titles of the ancient Libyans. And it also, it means the first people, but it also means the sparkling people. It also means the blue sands, and all of that. So we're going to get into that in an upcoming article. But they're well-ornamented on one hand, aper, but they're also the ones who are nomadic, moving, crossing over, all these different things. These people have been around for over 10,000 years. They've been practicing the same ancestral religion, worshiping the same divinities, including Amen and Set and Osar and Set, Heru, and the various divinities. It was only recently that they got caught up in Islam, some of them, many of them. So now they've blended the practices, similar to what Haitian Vodun. Some people are corrupted with Christianity, but then they still try to practice Vodun in addition to that, which is still corrupted because you really cannot practice both. And that's why it's corrupt now, until people start purging that nonsense. But some of our people on the continent have done that. It's not just the Fulani or the Pel. It's also Yoruba people, Akan people, people in Mende-speaking people, many people who have embraced Christianity or embraced Islam or embraced some foolish form of Judaism or Hebrewism or Sufism or some other nonsense. They also still practice naming ceremonies, still pour libation, still engage in divination, still do different things, and they're trying to blend the two, which is corrupt, and that's why the systems are corrupt. But people are still doing that. So it's not just the Fula who started incorporating Islamism or Christianity and Judaism, which is all the same tradition, but it's really no difference between the three in reality. It's the same nonsense. So they've been incorporating this biblical nonsense over the past few centuries, but undergirding that, they've always had their traditional religion. So this is where the term Aperu comes from. There was no individual named Eber. Of course, there was no Abraham who was descended from somebody named Eber. Has nothing to do with any of that. So you can see images. In fact, in our book, Afraka, Afrakai, The Origin of the Term Africa, if you go in part four, we have some images specifically of Fulani Berber. There's a difference between the term Aperu, Peru, Fula, Fula, and then Berber. It's not the same term. It's related, but it's not the same term. That's why you have Fulani Berbers and some people who are Berbers who are not Fula. So we get into that. Let me see if we have any calls on that. Okay, I see somebody has their hand up, so let me see. Okay, Michiawo, 7970, you have a question or a comment?
Peace, brother Kwesi. I just had a question on the book that you were referring to earlier when you were speaking about the destruction of mankind. Do you all
right.
Publish that?
Oh, you can. Although I excerpt a lot of it from in the Kuku Tum Tum, if you just Google the destruction of mankind, like ancient Egypt, destruction of mankind, there are numerous sites that have, you know, transliteration, translation, and so forth. You can get that from a numerous different sites. So you can either type in Google Book of the Cow of Heaven or just type in destruction of mankind, ancient Egypt, and you'll find numerous sites where you can find that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, no problem. So.
That's up.
Okay. All right, so I just want to go through some of the comments in the chat room, see if I've missed anything. And as the thing is, as you go through the Kuku Tum Tum, the ancestral jurisdiction, we show the origin of Abraham, Isaac, Ishmael, Moses and Aaron, David, Solomon, Sheba, Menelik, of course, the fictional character Jesus, who never existed of any race whatsoever, Yeshua ben Bandera, Muhammad, Bilal, Buddha, Brahman. We go through all of them, and we show the specific deities in ancient Kemet that they stole the descriptive titles from and the functions from, and they took those titles, corrupted them, and added them to fictional characters, fictional white characters who never existed. So they decided they wanted to create a god to make us worship, to manufacture one, but they couldn't just throw one at us. They had to give that fictional character attributes. So they create a statue of a white person. They have to give it a name. They give it a name that's similar to the one that we are already familiar with. They have to give it attributes like a sun divinity or earth divinity or a healer or whatever. They take those attributes from what they observed about the divinity that we were talking about. And then they apply that to these fictional characters and then try to sell these fictional characters like, well, this is the deity we've been working with and this is why we were able to invade the country and all this other nonsense that some of our people will believe. Well, maybe they really are working with the deity or else they wouldn't have taken over, as opposed to focusing on the reality that because we were at war with one another, those were the only periods in true history when the whites and their offspring were able to invade and be successful. Any time when we were not engaged in war with one another, we were able to defeat them militarily on a regular basis. So some of our people will fall for that nonsense, but however, it took thousands of years for the whites and offspring to, you know, incrementally force the fake traditions in. And the reason they were able to get in was because, of course, some of the immaturity of people believing what they were saying, but mostly because you have disgruntled people who wanted to be in leadership who were not. Those are the people who would normally cause a fracturing within the society and which will lead to civil war. Normally, we would have a civil war, fight against each other. Somebody would lose. At some point, we would make amends over time, intergenerationally, and we would reconnect and reconstitute and keep the civilization going. The difference was when the whites and their offspring entered this fray, this fracturing, they used to try to invade militarily. We would crush them, but then they started trying to enter the fracturing where once the fracture happens, they unite with one side and try to help them take the other side out. Or they would switch allegiances and try to help the other side take the other side out. And now we're fighting against each other. We have some help, but then they switch sides and get to the other side, causing chaos, but we're still at each other. We don't have that normal process of eventually stop ceasing the hostilities, making amends, reconnecting, reconstituting ourselves, and getting back to normal. Once they took advantage of that situation of the disgruntled and gave the disgruntled an opportunity that they never had before, which is maybe we can take our level of disgruntlement and turn it into a whole new culture and society and wage war against the dominant culture, then that caused a fracturing that we hadn't recovered from and it took time to recover from. So let me see. Anybody else have any other comments there? Okay. So go through all that information. We go into detail in the Kuku Tum Tum. We show the Apiru, which are the Fula people. We show images of them in Afraka, Afrakai, the origin of the term Africa. This is where you get the Apiru from. Outside of that, when you talk about Apirehui, which is a title of Tehuti, as we said before, Iprehu or Iprehui, this is where you get Iprehu or Hebrew from. It doesn't have anything to do with the Apiru people, meaning the Fula people who have been around for thousands of years. They have nothing to do with any bloodline from Abraham or anything else. They're just the same Fula people who've been around, just like the Twa people have been around, the so-called Pygmies, but the Twa people, the short-statured people, they've been around for thousands of years, really millions of years. They're doing the same thing now they were doing 100,000 years ago. The Fula people are doing the same thing now that they were doing 10,000 years ago nonstop, except for when some of them have been invaded with Islam, Christianity, and Hebrewism and that nonsense and accepted that nonsense recently. But prior to that, they were practicing the same ancestral religion they've always been practicing. Okay, so we went through, we went through these various topics. One other quick topic, one quick designation that people had been trying to deal with. We went through African. We talked about black. We talked about Moor, nigger, God, Hebrew, and so forth. We can deal with the Asiatic term very quickly, because it's very simple. Whites and their offspring don't know where the term Asia comes from. They think it comes from Akkadian or Akkadian, meaning Asu, meaning the east or the land of the sunrise. They're not sure. Etymologically, they can't find the origin of the term. Asi or Su or Asu, they don't know. Now, if you look, first of all, in the language of Kemet, Si is a term that they use for Asia. And Situ is a term they use for Asiatic. So the term doesn't originate in the Akkadian language, and the reason why the whites and their offspring say they don't know, of course, is because whenever they say they don't know the actual root, it's usually because it comes from ancient Afuraka, Afuraka, and they don't want to acknowledge where the roots come from. Situ for the people, and Situ meaning Asia, just like you have the region in southern Kemet called new beast. The Romans used that title, and a new beast gets corrupted into Nubia or Nubia. You have feet in ancient Kemet dealing with Western Asia. Feet becomes Sia or Asia, Asia. It's like Nubia becomes Nubia when the Europeans repeat the term and then apply it in different ways, sometimes ways that we normally originally didn't apply it. They did this Nubia becomes Nubia in Latin. Seat becomes Sia in the language of the white offspring, which is our reference for Asia. Now, what does seat? It can mean a number of different things. Seat, you see them in the Medutu. You'll see the arrow penetrating something. So it's talking about a releasing, an effusion, a release, something coming out of something, just like an arrow comes out of something and releases, something being released, so an effusion. Water coming out of something, a flow. Sometimes they'll use it for a libation, something coming out of something. But very interestingly, not only libation to make water or an effusion, but also they would show in the determinative a man standing and there's water coming out of him, but he's urinating. So it's urination. It's water coming out and effusion. It can also mean, you know, arrows coming out. It can mean seed, something, an outpouring of seed, like seed coming out of something, vases, water, vessels. It can also talk about rays of light and effusion of rays of light coming out of something, just like rays of light coming out of the sun. It can also mean a smell, odor, coming out of, you know, a smell coming out of something. And the Medute is the symbol representing a foul odor with an effusion of aroma coming out. So just like you can have a pleasant odor, which is an aroma or a scent or a perfume, you can also have a foul odor. So you have feet, meaning something emerging or exuding from something, a determinative of a man urinating. So that exudation is something coming out, feet, which later becomes sia. It also, rays of light coming out of something, water coming out of something, odor coming out of something. But not just the odor, it also can be a boil, an ulcer. Swelling with, you know, pus coming out of something, a bad smell or a scent. So when we're talking about an exudation, secretion of something coming out of something, which one is it when it's talking about Asia or seat? Again, we said seat is literally the term that we use for Asia. Seat in Kemet, Sia or Asia or Asia, according to the Europeans. Meaning an effusion, something being released. Is it the, for example, when it's talking about a smell exuding from somebody, is it talking about a pleasant smell, or Asia is the pleasant smelling land, or is it talking about the foul smell or the odor? Is it talking about the pus coming out of the body, or is it talking about, you know, natural sweat coming out of the body or rays of sunlight coming out of the body? The reason the Weiss and our offspring said Asu or Asio may be talking about the land of sunrise or the rays of light emerging, because one of the terms for siti means rays of sunlight emerging. However, there's a cosmological context that must be taken into account. When we refer to the sit and the situ, the people of sit, later Sia or Asia, when the people of ancient Kemet referred to the Asiatics, they refer to them as vile. They refer to them as criminal. They refer to them as excrement. They were the lowest level. They were not allowed to even enter into the temple. People who were unclean, unwashed, people who were mentally ill, as well as Asiatics, were not allowed into the temples of Kemet. We saw them no different than insane individuals. And when we talked about insane individuals, talking about mad individuals, madness, mental illness, for us that meant people who are spirits of disorder, plagued by spirits of disorder, criminal-type spirits. They were not allowed in the temples. Asiatics weren't allowed in the temples. People who were insane weren't allowed in the temples. People who were unwashed or filthy were not allowed in the temple. So Asiatics were associated with the filthy, the degenerate, and the spiritually disordered, insane. So when this specific term, seep, meaning that which flows out from somebody, and the particular term when it's showing the determinative of the man urinating, that's waste flowing out. That's the filth flowing out. So that particular seep is what we're talking about. When it talks about seep, meaning the smell or the odor, and it's a foul smell flowing out, that's the seep we're talking about. When it's talking about a swelling and then the pus coming out of the swelling, the pus coming out of the sore, and it's filth and degenerate, that's the seep we're talking about. The Asiatics were not looked upon as equals of the people of ancient Kemet. They were looked upon as enemies, lowlifes, degenerates, and so forth. Now, you also have, and now there were also, hold on 1 second, I want to get this particular piece. And we did mention, of course, the reason why they try to associate it with the sun, you know, and the sun rays exuding, because they knew that had a related meaning. Also, when they show the arrows coming through, arrows being released from something, the people who were Bedouin, the whites and their offspring who were invading from outside of Kemet and coming in the desert regions, they were also, you know, had their bows and arrows, and they were attacking the people. So they would see the people with the bows and arrows. Those happened to be the people who were also the enemies. They were also the ones who were filthy, degenerate, unwashed, spiritually disordered. They were the Sikh, or the Sikh people, the Sia people, the Asia people, Asiatic people, the Asian people, and so forth. Now, there's another, and this is going on for thousands of years, the vile Asiatic. You'll see that when in the text of Mer in Tahuti, or so-called Manetho, in the late period, but going back thousands of years before that, the Asiatics were seen as vile. So for thousands of years, they have the same designation. So therefore, when you're looking at the versions of the term Sikh, of course it means Sikh or Sia Asia, the versions of the exudation being filthy, urine, odor, pus, and all this other stuff, these are the kinds of exudations that they're talking about. And for thousands of years, they have the same focus. Now, there's another connection to that. The Mediterranean Sea is called Watch Ur, the Great Green, because of the color of the water and so forth. The deity that governs the Mediterranean Sea is called Heat, H-I, Heat, that's a divinity, a sacred force in nature governing a body of water. That's a divinity. That's divine order. By the time the Greeks get to ancient Kemet and they're reporting on ancient Kemet and they're talking about the Mediterranean Sea, Plutarch in his Isis and Osiris says that when he's talking to the Egyptians, they refer to the Mediterranean Sea as a tainted secretion. So you go from thousands of years of the Mediterranean Sea being watched for, or the Great Green, with a deity governing the Great Green, the divinity called He. And now all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, thousands of years later, by the time the whites and their offspring are all around the Mediterranean after they have invaded, after they have taken over, they're in the Asian Sea, Greece, of course, and Rome, and all around the Mediterranean, they're in North Africa, and they take over the northern part of Kemet. Now, the Mediterranean that was inhabited by a divinity is now a tainted secretion, a polluted secretion. is an exudation, something that's released, an effusion, just like the water, like urine coming out of a person. It's a tainted secretion now, as opposed to a sacred body of water, because the whites and their offspring are all around, encamped all around, in the areas all around this tainted secretion. This is directly related to, for thousands of years, the Asiatics, when they show up, because at first they were not in these areas, the whites and their offspring had not invaded these areas yet. It was just our people. Whites and their offspring invade, they pollute. Their exudation is rape, and they pollute the blood circle of people. They also pollute the language of the people. So there you develop these, quote-unquote, Afro-Asiatic or Semitic terms and language structure, language family, so-called. So there's a perversion of the people, there's a perversion of the culture, there's a perversion of the area, the actual territory. There's a pollution of the sea, pollution of the waters, pollution, just like people pollute water now and pollute, you know, sacred rivers in Ghana. You pollute a sacred river in Ghana, the Abosom of the river is not going to dwell in a polluted area. You pollute the ocean, to pollute, you know, a sea, the divinities that govern those areas are not going to dwell in those areas and connect with the people if you're polluting it. If the whites and their offspring are taking up residence all over these areas, the divinities don't work with the whites and their offspring. So now the water, instead of heat, the divinity heat becomes, now the water, the watch ore, becomes a tainted secretion. And it's the same thing with Sia, Asia. And it's talking about the term literally means a secretion, an effusion. What kind of secretion? It became a tainted secretion. The Asiatics are vile. They're like the mentally ill. They're unwashed, meaning they're tainted. They're mad and so forth. They're criminal. So this is where the term Asiatic, and so forth comes from. So people who refer to themselves as Asiatic foolishly are referring to themselves as spiritually ill, mentally ill, tainted, perverse, like urine, all kinds of nonsense, like pus, vile, foul odor, degenerate, criminal. That's what Asiatic means. This is why the whites and their offspring want us to believe that we're Asiatic. We're not Afurakani, Afurakaitni. We're Asiatic, and we're all these negative, idiotic, nonsensical things. So, and that can, of course, you can find that information in the language of Kemet. You can find a hieroglyphic dictionary with regard to the title of Sia, Asia, that we use in ancient Kemet. So we dealt with that Asiatic, dealt with the Hebrew, who are not Aperu. When it's Abraham, Isaac, Ishmael, Iprahui, Shek, and Smaul, as well as Moshe and Aran, which became Moshe and Aran, or Moses and Aaron. We disposed of all of that in the Kukutun Tomb, and there's much more detail in that book. Of course, last week we dealt with the origin of the term God, nigger, Moor, black, African, and so forth. So we've hit all those different definitions. Let me see. Anybody has any more questions? Okay, I see one hand up.
Yes. How are you doing, Quasera, Nefertar?
Let me tell you.
Yes. One thing earlier in discussion. One important question, besides these so-called stupid Israelites, I was wondering about these things that people go follow of what they call Nawapu. Where did that came from,
right?
Much as if there is even an origin to it? That's my question.
Okay, so the Nawapians are just, you know, he's gone through, first of all, for people who don't know, Nawapu or Nawapians, prior they were called Nubian Islamic Hebrews, the Ansar Allah community, a number of different things they've switched up on, right? So years ago, and the character Malachi Z. York is in jail right now. He is a dissexual, homosexual, he's a rapist, and a pedophile. So he's a homosexual, rapist, pedophile who admitted to a numerous counts of transporting children across lines when they were taking them down into Atlanta, raping these little boys and little girls and grown men and women and so forth. He admitted to that in court. He's a faggot, and many of the Nuwabians are homosexuals as well. That's why they support him. That's why they vigorously defend him, because they are engaged in that kind of nonsense. They are also, many of them are pedophiles and things like that. Then you have some people who are just ignorant, didn't know anything about the information, and they joined up with it. But a lot of them are part of that kind of, that's what they engage in, so that's why they love to be around that kind of nonsense. But all they were just Muslims, and they were studying Moorishism, they were studying Islam, they were studying Christianity. They used to say that the Ankh was a sign, devil worship. Then when information about ancient Kemet got popular, then they flipped around and all of a sudden they were ancient Egyptians. He talks about coming from another galaxy. He comes from another galaxy. He's not from this earth. All kinds of nonsense and a bunch of fools who follow this fool. He's always been an agent of the whites and their offspring, and this is what they do with their agents. They let them run game for a couple of decades, get a lot of followers, and they lock them up, and then they increase their followers because now he becomes a martyr, and now people are fighting for him. You know, the idiots are fighting for him. But it's just a little small cult. Most people have nothing to do with it. He would take information from a bunch of different sources and weave it all together. The vast majority of it is absolute nonsense, nonsensical, inaccurate. Of course, he will copy things from other, you know, just basic historians and biologists and other people and linguists and try to make it sound, you know, you have to get something true. So you copy something from the book written by a linguist, copy something from a book written by a biologist, copy something from a book written by a geneticist, copy something from a book written by an engineer, copy something from a book written by somebody who's engaged in so-called mysticism or esotericism or something like that, which is still misinformation. Weave it all together. Some people think it's accurate. When they check out some of those little quotes, it sounds accurate. Then you can feed them all the nonsense about you coming from another galaxy and, you know, the 144,000 and all this foolishness.
Yeah, the galaxy, you know, was a little bit crazy. Yeah, the galaxy don't make no sense. It being some so-called galaxy really is very much crazy, much less nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really, so, but continue. Go ahead.
But we have, you know, we have a lot of, now did you have another question, or that was it?
Well, I was going to ask one particular with the Hebrew Israelites, because some are even what they consider a so-called nation. They follow the stupid Bible and say they were this and that. And from my understanding, me checking them out, from one particular other person that exposed them a little bit, on one particular debate, is that it said people don't understand when the so-called Reverend Martin Luther King died, the next year the same system, the government created the same, the 501c3 thing, where all the church take now and also, and the Hebrew Israelite thing came around that year, the next year in 69, which really that's what really came them at, made them like what they call like just like the Islam and all. Crack dudes, you know what I'm saying? So at times to see how they, you know, when certain people start move in either a right or a wrong direction, the government change it on you and, you know, creates another type of distraction, you know, with this even giving them money and stuff. That I think I follow and I start to see now. Well, a lot of them, if we go back in their track record, where these guys come from, how it started, and let you know, say that these guys up here just spreading a whole bunch of misinformation, and then some people that follow and say that this and that are very much just find some way out how to the thing they were already in and jump into another thing. You know, crazy? Like some people that were Christians since they were birthed to now, once they find out that certain things that make no sense and they jump to some other following, and if that didn't work out, they go back to Christianity. So, you know, some of our people are not really all there, you know? Like they never left it at all, you know? That's what I'm starting to notice.
Right.
Wherever they were.
Right.
So at times when some people start to really give you the real thing, and then once we can't debate it, they still want to stay in that little comfort box they're in, like they don't want to let go, which is the very most difficult task, is trying to let go. But a lot of people say some people go insane and then let go. But I find, in my own opinion, that if you've been lied to from birth to now, and we try and find just enough to get the whole truth, and we know this is what we find is a lie, and anything else, we have to make, well, mostly we have to make the commitment to it, now let it go. Regardless, you can't let it go until you can't function in life. It tells you how far much you don't want to let go. Because what you going to do? You're going to kill yourself? You're going to go back to drugs? Like some people say that, some people don't want, one person told me, said that it was wise not to try waking certain people because they feel some people, whatever they were doing, that was negative, and they were doing this just to get out of that negativity. If they know what is holds true and they know it's a lie, they're going to go back to it. So it makes me think, say, were they ever even wanted to free themselves, period, if they really wanted the real truth? Because nowadays, some people not really handling the real truth with the information that you're sending out, or anybody that wants to break down that what you mean, what anybody that's learning anything from Christianism or all this, that it never was real, and it's fake, and it's just another way of confusing to lead you more, you know, down the rabbit hole, or whatever the hell they want to call it. I mean, that's what
right.
I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah, and may I say for the call, okay, and yeah, the when people say, you know, you don't want to, you know, if this is working for them, you don't want to, you know, take them away from it because they, you know, it's going to make them even worse. That's people talking, number one, out of ignorance, number two, out of being already defeated. They feel like they will never know the truth. They're saying, I don't know what the truth is. I don't know anything. So since we don't know anything, therefore we have to build based on we don't know anything. So therefore we're stuck. It's just like saying, if somebody's on crack, well, don't take the crack away from them, because if you take it away from them, then they're going to do heroin, and you don't want them doing that, so just let them stay on crack until they die from that. That's foolishness. Just say that you don't know what the answers are, and then seek out what the answers are. We embrace reality, and yes, we remove people from, take all of that nonsense from our people and replace it with real information. That's what we're here to do, and that's what any of our people can do. With regard to the Hebrew groups in the 60s, yeah, they did start putting those 501c3 threes together, and Black people were able to really move on that heavy, but the Hebrew groups go back before that. A lot of these groups all started around the early so-called 1900s. So you can go back to, you know, in New York, not just the so-called Morris Science Temple during those times, but then you had a number of things happening in New York. You had the people, the commandment keepers, you know, going back into the early, you know, towards World War I around that time. For almost 100 years, little Hebrew groups, Moorish Hebrew groups, Moorish Science Temple, Nation of Islam, all going back to around that early part of the previous century. They started forming these little groups. Our people, and it starts off with, as we were talking to the brother Kamal Casey Tahuti when he wrote the book, How to Make a Negro Christian. He showed how they started forcing Christianity on us near the end of enslavement and into the early part of the previous century. Just like they were heavily promoting that, some of our people weren't going to go for Christianity, but then whites and offspring give you something else. They give you Christianity, or give you Hebrewism, or they give you Moorishism, or they give you Islam, or they give you some nonsense about extraterrestrials, or some nonsense occult, pseudo-information, or some Sufism, or they give you, lost landism. You're talking about you're from Mu, or you're from Atlantis, or some other nonsense. Pseudo-New Age spirituality, they'll slide you some pseudo-Native American spirituality, and if you overcome all of that, then they try to give you drugs, alcohol, you know, crack, cigarettes, of course. You get beyond all of that information and all of that, all those traps, and of course they step it up a notch. Now they're trying to decriminalize marijuana specifically so our people who haven't fallen for a lot of these other things, they'll become drug addicts. They want us to be a nation of zombies, a nation of drug addicts. Marijuana destroys our abatum, destroys our melanin. It perverts sperm cells, perverts ovum cells. It opens a synaptic cleft in the brain so the transmissions between neurons are spaced out, and this is why you get spaced out and you can't think straight. All kinds of nonsense. But then they condition our people are so brainwashed and so conditioned that, you know, the drug is introduced to them, and they start saying, well, this is natural, it comes from the earth, and the white man is trying to keep it from us, and we really need it. There's no difference than if the white from the offspring introduced crack and told us, well, it's natural, it comes from the earth, and you should really have it, but there are other white people trying to keep it from you, so we're going to fight to make sure that you can have all the crack you want, and we're going to decriminalize it so we can help you. And some Negroes will go along with that, and they will jump on campaigns trying to promote the use of crack. Just like Negroes who are, you know, self-destructive, they promote the use of marijuana because it destroys your perception physically, it destroys your body, it destroys your brain cells, it destroys your perception, and it also opens you up to negative discarnate spirits, discarnate relatives as well as non-relatives, and therefore they distort your perception as well. So you come up with foolish rationales, imbecilic rationales for continuing to use the drug that the whites and offspring put in the community to destroy us, and we're coming up with ridiculous rationalizations, idiotic nonsense about how it's natural. And we're engaged in a self-destructive process jump-started by the whites and offspring. So that's another trap that they use, alcohol, drugs, and these fake religions. And some of our people fall for that. But they have something for as many people as possible. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hebrewism, all these organizations were fundamentally founded by the whites and their offspring. Sometimes they'll try to point to a black founder, but when you look beyond the black founder, you will always find one of the whites and their offspring behind these Hebrew groups going back 100 years, behind the Nation of Islam, behind the Moorish Science Temple. There's always one of the whites and their offspring behind the foundation of these groups. One thing they did not want us to do is embrace our ancestral religion, because it was always when we embraced our ancestral religion that we were motivated to stage these revolts, kill the whites and their offspring, free ourselves from plantations, take over a nation like Haiti, or wage war against the whites and their offspring in the southern United States and establish maroon settlements and so forth. And we forced them through military exercises and attacks to end enslavement. And they didn't want that to continue. They already were forced to end enslavement. They had to figure out a way to do something different to make sure we would be mentally and culturally enslaved so they could still have slaves. So they knew that the only way that they could continue that process was to corrupt the religion and give us a fake religion, because it was our embrace of ancestral religion which motivated us to end enslavement. They knew if we were to embrace that fully, we would end the cultural and political enslavement that we're under right now. This is why they'll give you any kind of pseudo-spiritual tradition as long as it's not your ancestral religion. And as long as it doesn't incorporate divine order, which is comprised of divine law and divine hate. Now, they see many of us moving towards ancestral religion, so they can't stop the move, so they decided to infiltrate as much as possible themselves and their culture. So now whenever you type in Orisha, Yoruba, or some Bodun or something like that, the first thing you'll see on Google is white people and homosexuals. And people who don't know any better will assume that, oh, if you embrace African religion, that means you have to accept white people and you have to accept homosexuality and you have to be tolerant and you can't be this and can't be that and all the nonsense that goes along with these fake priests and priestesses and money and drugs and smoking and alcohol and giving alcohol to the deities and they're demanding money and all this other foolishness. This is all white infiltration trying to stop us from embracing Nana Song. But they're not going to be able to stop it. We're going to stop them. And we're going to bring an end to them and this is part of the process of Ojida purification. So with that, I don't think there's any more calls. And that's okay, that's cool. So may I say, everybody, for tuning in, tomorrow, Egua Marketplace, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will have Brother Coach Bilal Sankofa. We'll be going over the great work that he's doing in the community, so please tune in for that. We will be in Hartford, Connecticut this coming Saturday, July 19th, Las Vegas. We're working on an event for July 12th. Possibly in Baltimore, so we will keep you updated on that, so hit us up on Facebook. Also, we are raising funds for these events so we can give out the free books as well as go out to the community and share this information with our people. So you can go to our website, ojirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-S, as in free, O.com, and go to the publications section. You can purchase the soft cover publications. We have 7 books out in soft cover. They only range from $8 to $11. You can purchase those retail, or if you want to be a distributor, you can buy a minimum of 10 books at a discounted price, and you can sell them retail wherever you are in your area. Or if you just want to make a purchase, we also have option on the same page, on the publications page, if you want to make a donation towards the work that we are doing, because we also have services such as the substance abuse abstinence, domestic violence, intergenerational trauma, and transcarnational trauma, where we assist people to overcome these issues. These services, of course, are free. We have ritual methods within ancestral culture to address these various issues. So all of our publications in the PDF format and our services are free to the Afro-Aikani community, and, of course, our community only. So if you'd like to make a donation, Achedie, we appreciate that. Yerase, we thank you for that. Any amount is fine. It's on the same page with the publications, same page as the publications. So you can order publications and or make a contribution. If you want us to come to your city, just hit us up on the contact us section. Our email address is there on the website. You can also hit us up on Facebook. We are afuraka.afurakaet on Facebook. And Yerase again, and we will check you out tomorrow. That's it.